Welcome to episode... Fuck, I forgot the episode number.
Episode 109.
Welcome to GBW episode 109. My name is Chris, and with me is Josh.
Hello.
How is everybody? Before we get into anything,
can't hear them answering, man.
Doesn't matter. Before that, let's get into something. A couple days ago, I want to address this. We lost a true B-movie legend.
Yes, we did.
Mr. Larry Cohen has left the building. And I just wanted to quickly put out there how much I personally appreciate everything he did. Because even though I might not have liked all of his movies, he was a very unique creator in genre films. And, you know, just look at his filmography if you want proof. It's Alive, Cue the Winged Serpent, Bone, Hell Up in Harlem, all those good movies. The Stuff, wrote Phone Booth, which was on my underrated 2000s list.
Yeah.
And, you know, had a big career doing television before that, and really seemed like a really genuine, happy guy, really felt like he appreciated all of his fans and where he was. So he'll be missed. Anything to add?
I think he, you know, him along with Bill Lustig, I think have given us a real sort of interesting view of New York City, unlike a lot of people. Larry Cohen, I think he made 4 or 5 movies specifically in New York that he did stuff in LA as well as New York. But, you know, I think of movies like God Told Me To and Q.
Yep.
And they really do give you really get a sense of New York in that time period, just like Lustig with Maniac and Maniac Cop. So, yeah, and the other thing he's just one of those guys that I felt like the world of cinema was still okay because Larry Cohen was still around, but now he's not, and I feel like something's wrong, and it just feels like he was too young, mm-hmm. and I feel like he still had stuff to offer, and I think he was still excited about doing stuff, and yeah, it's a real drag, and it was a real shock too, like there was no indication to the fans that there was a problem. So and I don't even know what he died of. I don't know. So it was a real shocker to wake up to that.
Exactly. And just one other thing on that is if you really want to see what kind of guy he was, I highly recommend the documentary from last year, King Cohen. It was very close to being on my year-end top 5, but it just got nudged out. You can watch it on Shudder if you have Shudder.
Yeah.
Or you can just rent it on demand or buy the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray comes with a CD copy of the soundtrack as well.
Nice.
So worth seeking out for sure, and definitely will miss the guy.
Totally.
Okay. So with that out of the way.
Well, wait a second.
We got another one.
Yes.
I think I know who you're doing. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, we just got to also quick. Mention one of the most memorable villains of the 80s. And that would be Mr. Joe Pilato.
Yep.
Of course, Rhodes from Day of the Dead.
Joe got him!
Exactly. He didn't do a ton of movies that, you know, were known or anything, but definitely made an impression in Day of the Dead. And, again, kind of shocking. Like, he was, again, younger than Larry Cohen.
Yeah, and kind of overshadowed by Larry Cohen, to be honest, because it happened the day after.
Well, so. I mean...
It just sucks to lose two genre... like icons in a way in a span of 2 days. It really is a blow to horror fans like us.
Yeah. So, I mean, especially after my, jaunt to Calgary last year for Calgary Horror Con, this kind of stuff really, really makes me want to go and do more of that. So, yeah.
Okay.
Got to meet these guys while they're around.
That's true. Just like when if you're into music and there's a legacy artist coming that you really want to see, get your ass out there.
I know.
Because, you know, I missed out on many, many artists that way too.
Yeah.
So, this episode, because this podcast is not niche enough, we've decided to focus on a specific film company. And mostly the reason I wanted to do this is because... when we watched Band of the Hand, I saw that the logo for this company come up, and I heard the theme music, and I was like, this company was a pretty big part of me growing up.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about movies they put out that I think are rad that people probably don't know or maybe have not got around to seeing yet. So we're going to talk about the mighty flying Pegasus that is TriStar Pictures. But our parameters are we're only going to talk about the first 15 years of TriStar Pictures. So basically, 84 to 1999 is what the parameters we gave ourselves was, because honestly, after that, they're still in existence, but they're only really putting out one or two movies every year. They're not the powerhouse they were in this 15-year span we're covering. So that's what we're going to get to.
Yep.
But first, let's talk about what we've watched. And I realized before we started that I did not work out the order that we have to go in, so we're just going to fucking wing it.
Got it.
So if I have to do like two in a row more than once, so be it, as long as we end where we need to be.
Got it.
I'll start.
Yes.
Since I have more.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start with my jaunt to the theater.
The theater.
I went to opening day of a little movie that made $71 million this past weekend from Jordan Peele called Us.
Yeah.
This was my second most anticipated movie of the year.
Yeah.
After, obviously, Tarantino. And, you know, I really loved Get Out. Get Out was on my year-end list when the year it came out, is one of my favorite movies of the year. And I'm happy to report that Us is not, you know, it's not not on the level of Get Out, but still really good and really worth going to see. Don't want to talk too much about the plot, simply because the plot's kind of, it's kind of important that you don't know a lot going in. Let's just say it's about a family headed by Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave and her husband, Winston Duke, and their two kids. They're going to their vacation home, and then events from the past 30 years start to catch up to her and leads to, you know, being terrorized by people who seem to be very similar to them. And that's all I'm going to say about the plot. It goes very Twilight Zone-y plot later in the movie, but you need to go into this one pretty blind. Like, just a basic one-line thing that I just did is enough for you.
Yeah.
It was like Get Out, a very decent balance of suspense and humor. And the thing that I find about the Jordan Peele movie so far is that this is a guy who started in sketch comedy with, you know, Key and Peele. I believe he was on Mad TV too. And he's transitioned into making genre films. But he hasn't made it so that the comedic elements of his movies kind of overshadow the suspense thriller elements. It's very subtle. It's not overdone. Like, I thought the same thing about Get Out. And it's a nice surprise because this is a guy known for comedy. Mm-hmm. And he's not letting the comedy overwhelm the story. Much like Get Out, a lot of this is very, you know, focused on timely allusions to things going on in the real world at the moment. Like, there's a lot of deeper meaning to the stuff going on if you really want to dig to it. I don't really want to talk about that right now. I just want to talk about it, the movie itself. I mean, sure, I get the analogies he's doing in the movie, and I understand what he's doing. But as an entertainment, Us is an entertaining movie, most definitely. Obviously, a very ambitious Twilight Zone. I've mentioned Twilight Zone twice now, like idea, and it makes sense because he's in charge of the new reboot of Twilight Zone.
Right.
So it makes sense for it to be kind of inspired by that. I did find, unlike Get Out, this one does lose its footing a little bit. So I didn't quite like it on the level because it does lose its footing. But Nyong'o's performance of this, top notch. Like, there is a reason that she was nominated for an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave. And she's like really, really magnetic to watch in this. Like, she's really good in this. Duke as the dad, he's kind of like that, you know, the jokey dad joke kind of guy. Really good in this too.
Right.
So the cast in general is totally solid, totally sells you on the story, and that helps make it work even more than it does. There's a really, really great moment involving the Beach Boys and NWA that I don't want to talk much more about, but it's my favorite scene in the movie. And it's just the thing I like about Peele is that he's taking his inspiration and showing you his inspiration. So in Get Out, he's showing you, I'm inspired by Stepford Wives and whatever. In this one, he's like, I'm kind of inspired by, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers and stuff like that. But he's bringing his own original spin to it that's making these movies, you know, and also because he's tying it in with what's going on in the real world, they're making them more timely and they're making them feel fresher than if it was just a straight ripoff.
Yeah.
So I recommend you see this one in the theater for sure, especially if you liked Get Out.
Right.
I don't believe it's on the level of Get Out because, let's be honest, Get Out was Oscar nominated.
Yeah.
But it is a really good, solid, entertaining, funny, violent, unexpected at times genre film.
Cool.
And successful. He's made two movies. I've liked both of them. I'm excited for his Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
So let's see what this guy does next.
Nice.
So, any interest?
No.
No? Okay.
I'll probably watch it eventually. I didn't like Get Out that much.
Yeah, so, I know you were kind of iffy on it, so I was just wondering.
I know I'm one of the few, but
No, but there's even people who I know that didn't like Get Out that are more interested in seeing this.
Yeah, like I thought it was okay. Like I didn't hate it. I wasn't like but I felt like I missed out on something. Like feel like I missed something on it because I just didn't feel the passion like you do and a lot of people do. So it just wasn't for me. This one, the poster kind of lost me a little bit. I was just kind of like, it's just not a poster I was that interested in. Similar to Get Out.
Yeah.
So, you know, his movies just aren't grabbing me. And then when I did try Get Out, I'll give this a shot for sure. I do like her.
But she's really good in this.
But I'm not in a hurry to see it right away.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But if you're a fan of Get Out, then I would say, get your ass to the theater and
get
see
out.
It. Yeah, get out to the theater. Come with us and see the movie. All right. So that's us.
All right. Okay. Let's start with I Revisited from 1995 from another director of color, Ernest Dickerson. I decided to revisit Demon Knight.
Nice.
Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight.
Billy Zane's greatest moment.
Who's that?
Billy Zane's greatest moment.
Billy Zane was amazing in this. We've talked about this. I think this was on my underrated 90s, I think.
We've talked about this movie
we've
more
talked
than
about
once.
It a lot with Todd Masters on episode 50, so if you want to hear some behind the scenes stories, please go and revisit that episode. I think Chris and I both agree that's one of our best. So
We love that episode. That was a great time.
So I remember when this came out, it was the first feature film from the Tales of from the Crypt franchise. And I was pretty excited about it because it, you know, had the Crypt Keeper on the poster and it was about demons. And I've loved this movie for a long time. Directed by Ernest Dickerson, who, of course, has done like Bones and
Surviving the Game
and did a whole bunch
juice,
of Walking Dead.
You got the juice, son. Juice.
Yeah.
We've talked about that on an episode too.
And a lot of really good Walking Dead episodes.
Also an award-winning director of photography prior to that on like Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee movie and things like that.
Yeah. So he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
So love the opening for this movie. The Crypt Keeper. It's got the like, kind of classic opening. Then we've got a little like comedy bit with the Crypt Keeper and a nude Peggy Trentini. Who's Peggy Trentini, you ask? Well, she was one of the Swedish Bikini Team, if you remember them from the 80s. But she has a brief bit in this as does as does John Larroquette. So cool, fun little opening. Then we get into the movie proper. Opens with the song Hey Man, Nice Shot by Filter.
Yep.
Used really, really well in a car chase scene. And then we have, we're introduced to William Sadler playing Breaker. William Sadler, of course, great character actor. Most know him as Death from the Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
And he's returning in part three.
Yeah, he is returning, yeah. And he's this guy who has his key filled with the blood of Christ, and he's just trying to like figure out who he's supposed to pass the key on to. And he comes across this hotel, or more like a mission almost, populated by about six people. And then he has to face off against Billy Zane as the collector and his army of demons. So it's a pretty much a one location type movie, but with a really killer cast, killer effects by Todd Masters. I still think these are some of the best creature effects of the 90s. I love the demons in this movie. And then the gore gags are great. There was a lot more than I remembered. When I watched it this time, I'm like, oh shit, I forgot about that. And even the set's really cool. And the cast, I mean, the cast is what's really making this movie great. Jada Pinkett. I still like her because, she was really good in Gotham, as Fish Mooney. But this is one of her first roles, and she plays, Geraldine. I'm trying to say it like Billy Zane. Geraldine, I can't remember. But she's like this kind of like a convict who's like on a work release program that does kind of the chores around. CCH Pounder plays the woman who owns the
She's great in this.
Yeah, she's really great in this, and totally not used to seeing her in a horror movie too. Yeah. So, but she's a really great actress, so it really kind of sells it. Dick Miller, of course, is in this, playing Uncle Willie. Great. Thomas Hayden Church, awesome in this. And back then, you wouldn't have expected it, because he was mainly known for being on a comedy TV series called Wings.
Yeah.
He's since been in like the Oscar-nominated Sideways, and also Spider-Man 3. But he was great in this, as kind of this asshole, like, just redneck dude. Charles Fleischer, AKA the voice of Roger Rabbit, playing this postal worker who's in love with a hooker named Cordelia, played by Brenda Back. And you know her from Death Spa, and she played Lana Turner in LA Confidential. But really, really solid. All these guys are really, really well done, really, really talented. And Dickerson did a really good job of casting this movie, because there's no fat here. This is all really good actors that know what they're doing and are able to work together in an ensemble. And then Billy Zane, of course, is playing one of the best villains in modern genre movies. He's a smarmy guy, and he's funny, and but he's pretty threatening as well. And I just love him in this. He's just so full of personality. And he does these little bits in the movie where he's trying to entice the various characters, which plays into the plot as well. But he's when he's doing those bits, it's just hilarious. So if you haven't seen Demon Knight, absolutely recommend it. Great to see this on the Scream Factory Blu-ray. Haven't checked out the special features yet, but I'm looking forward to. There's a couple of commentaries on there, a behind-the-scenes segment. I know Todd Masters is featured in both, and I do believe that they do tell some stories about on this movie where, you know, they don't really hold back as to what they're talking about. So very looking forward to seeing that as well. So Demon Knight, I just feel like, is kind of getting a bit lost in the shuffle. You know, I just don't hear it being brought up a lot, but it still totally holds up, and I'd recommend it.
Yeah, even when we did our episode about like the 90s horror, Demon Knight was one that we were like, no, Demon Knight's a step above a lot of those.
Oh, totally.
And, you know, it's like you said, the effects work, Billy Zane at the most Billy Zane-est.
Yeah.
And even like, you're right, solid cast. CCH Pounder's great in this. I'm not a big fan of Jada Pinkett, but even I think she's really good in this as well. Really good in this as well. And it's just like, after this movie, I was so stoked for the Tales from the Crypt movies, right? And then along came Bordello of Blood, and I was like, I'm not so sure I'm on board anymore. And then Universal Pictures was like, I'm not so sure we're on board anymore either. So the third feature, the third and last feature, Ritual, ended up just being dumped. So
it did.
It's unfortunate, but Demon Knight, pick up that Blu-ray.
Well, because the 90s were like, this is post-Scream, so everyone was like, you know, into that stuff. And this was like an 80s creature feature in the middle of the 90s.
Yeah.
And it was just a breath of fresh air. So yeah,
grab that disc for sure.
Still great.
All right. What's next? I'm going to go in order for the most part. A documentary I was curious about that came out last year, just because I liked the subject. I watched Bad Reputation, the documentary about Joan Jett. Now, if you guys don't know who Joan Jett is, I feel sorry for you. And
everyone knows who Joan Jett is.
Everyone should know who Joan Jett is. Obviously, mostly known as being a founding member of the Runaways. And, you know, I Love Rock and Roll, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. And also just being nowadays seen as like a kind of like a feminine music icon in a way. Just like being one of those. She was a trailblazer who let other female artists kind of, you know, become what they are. A lot of them are featured in this doc. Music video director Kevin Kerslake's debut, I guess. He's directed videos for a lot of various artists. Like, I didn't write any down, but he's made a lot of music videos. And this is really his first full theatrical type documentary.
Are music videos still a thing?
They still have them on YouTube, dude. People still watch them.
Like, do people still make music videos?
Yeah.
I feel like such an old man.
They actually do. People still make, the artists still make music videos.
So interesting.
And they still get millions of views on YouTube.
Yeah, I guess they're just dumped to YouTube now.
Yeah, pretty much. So, we all know Joan Jett's a badass. We know this. But this kind of follows from her getting her first guitar when she was like, I think she was 13. She says to her parents, I want a guitar. And they go and buy her a shitty guitar amp combo from Sears so she can learn how to play guitar. From there, she's 15 years old, palling around outside the Rainbow Room and what have you down in L.A. and decides, hey, maybe I should try and start a band, and meets up with this guy called Kim Fowley, who kind of forms the Runaways, gathers together Joan Jett, gets Sherry Curry to be the singer / lingerie sporting sex pot, underage sex pot, and Lita Ford on guitar. And, you know, I unfortunately don't remember the other members because those are the three main focus of the band.
Sandy West,
yep. And sorry. Bass player.
I think it's Jackie something.
Yeah. But anyway, this is like a girl rock supergroup before girl rock supergroups existed. I think around the time the Runaways came out, the only other band that was an all-female rock band was Girl School. I'm pretty sure. Like, those were the only two ones that I popped to mind for me.
Yeah.
So she's in the Runaways. They have this run of four albums that last, like, I think there were four together for like 7-8 years, maybe tops. Sherry Curry drops out after the first couple albums. Then Joan Jett and Lita Ford take over like the vocal duties. And from there, she kind of like, this has come to a pass. Kim Fowley's out of the picture. He was a bit of a dick anyway, whatever. Yeah. He's pretty infamous. Look him up if you want to know about him. And she starts trying to make her own solo career and is not really getting anywhere. Is getting shut down. Can't really get anywhere. Makes a record that no label wants to really sign, even though the songs are like I Love Rock and Roll becomes popular and they're selling it out of the trunk of the car. And she's teaming up with what's the guy's name now? Kenny Laguna, who was known for working for the Buddha Records bubblegum pop kind of factory before hooking up with Joan. And then it just follows her building her own label and kind of getting some secondary success as a solo artist, and then her influence on everybody else leading up to, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame abduction and stuff like that. Okay. So it's a really interesting look at her. Like, if you know a lot about her, you're not going to learn a lot more new from this, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty basic, standard, across the board information. But that being said, it's really entertaining because they've peppered in a lot of archival footage and a lot of talking head interviews. You know, you've got
Henry Rollins, Dave and Grohl.
Yeah, Sherry Curry.
Am I right?
Yeah. Not Henry Rollins.
Sarcastic.
Not Henry Rollins. You've got Sherry Curry.
Yeah.
You've got Michael J. Fox, because she was in the movie Light of Day with her, him in 87. You got Debbie Harry, Iggy Pop, Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Kill. Mm-hmm. all talking about her, and and the only inclusion I don't agree with is fucking Miley Cyrus.
Oh yeah.
Because the first time Miley Cyrus is on screen, she tells a story about the first time she saw Joan Jett. She's like, I want to fuck her. Come on.
Yeah.
You're not that edgy, Miley Cyrus. Fuck off already. but, you know, it's got the great archival footage. It does have a lot of talking head interviews, which are fun. I found that it glosses over the modern era a bit too much because it feels to be rushing to the finish line by that point. But actually, what I really liked about this doc is the focus on Joan and Kenny Laguna, because they're just like, their interplay with each other and their chemistry with each other in the doc and in general in life is really inspiring, because like, they're just friends, they're best friends, they're not lovers or nothing like that, they're nowhere near that, but they act like an old married couple.
Right.
They argue with each other, they fight, but they still, at the core of each other, really care for each other and really want to help each other succeed. And it's that part of this doc that I'm like, that's really cool. Because you don't see that kind of stuff in a music industry these days.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. And Joan Jett's a badass.
Yeah.
So you need to check out Bad Reputation if you're at all interested in her. Because I think it's a really good overview of her career. Might not be like as deep as fans want it to go. But really worthwhile if you're curious about who she is and who she's influenced in her music and all that. And all the stuff about her forming her own record label because nobody wanted her was really interesting. So, yeah, it's a pretty cool doc. Pretty cool.
Nice. Cool. Oh, my turn again. Okay. So I dug into my Dollarama box.
This always ends sort of poorly.
Sorry, I've still got this cough. Actually, this didn't end that bad. So I pulled out one that I thought, oh, fuck.
Isn't that what all of them are?
I'll just get through this one.
Oh, fuck.
Well, I usually go for the crappiest ones first. Cause I'm just like, okay, I can just get rid of this.
You know what I started doing? Because I've got to tell you this one. I started doing it where, so for 2 years solid, you and I went crazy buying the Dollarama titles at Halloween. 1 year they were $2. The next year they were $2.50. So you start with the $2 ones because they're the oldest. You're like, fuck, this has been sitting here for like 3 years now.
See, I go the opposite.
Oh, you do the 250s and work your way back?
Because that's when I knew the titles weren't as good.
Oh, okay.
So I'm like, oh.
Got you. Okay. Yeah. That's right, because that year wasn't as good.
No.
Okay, anyway.
That's when I was just trying to keep the glory days alive.
Oh.
Because there was no more dump bins anymore either.
Right.
But I was still like, oh, it's horror movies at Halloween. $2.50, sure. But,
and then we're like, why did we fucking do that?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so what do we got?
$3 ones are the really bad ones. Okay. I picked up one called Open Grave.
I have this too.
Okay. From 2013, directed by Gonzalo Lopez Gallego. Only thing I know he's done is Apollo 18, that found footage moon landing thing.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that, to be honest.
It was okay, yeah. Okay, so this is one of these ones where, yeah, and again, like the one, like Us, I'm not going to talk much about the plot because the thing I really liked about this movie is you only know what the characters know in this movie. So the mystery is getting revealed as the characters are finding out too, which I really like. You don't see that too much. Like, you see it, but I mean, just in that way where you really have no fucking idea what's going on and you're learning with the characters, I really like that approach. So that's what happens in this. I will tell you the beginning. The beginning is Charlton Copley from District 9.
And A-Team.
And yeah.
Free Fire.
Yeah, I think he's actually turning out to be a pretty good actor. But he's this guy, and the movie opens on a tight shot of his eyes, and then it's revealed that he's like waking up on a pile of corpses in like a giant pit. And he's like waking up and like fucking realizing what's going on. Really effective opening scene. And he's on this pile of corpses. Anyway, he makes his way to this house. And then runs across four other people. But none of them have any idea what their identities are. And from there, It's just them kind of figuring each other out and also discovering the occasional like zombie-like creature in the surrounding woods. And I'm going to kind of leave it there because, they as the movie progresses, discover what's happening. And that's where I'm going to stop. But it was very, very effective. I thought it was shot really well. I thought it looked really good. Thought the performances were all really well done. Thomas Kretschmann's in this. Know him from mainly Dario Argento's movies. He was in Stendhal Syndrome, which is a great one. And he also played Dracula in the much maligned Argento's Dracula. But he was,
you're not kidding.
He was okay in, as Dracula, but that was about it.
Not the spider? Not the spider? Isn't it the spider?
It's a praying mantis.
Or praying mantis, sorry.
CGI.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay. Aaron Richards is in this. I love Aaron Richards. Aaron Richards plays Barbara Kane on Gotham. Again, I love Gotham. It's a great show. I'm sad it's ending this year, but she is fucking killer in Gotham, and she's it was really cool to see her in this because I didn't when I watched Gotham, I didn't really know her from anything else, so it was really cool to see her pop up. Guy named Joseph Morgan plays another character. He's on The Vampire Diaries and The Originals, so if you're a fan of those shows, might be worth checking this out for him. And yeah, it's just, it was a big surprise. I was just expecting a big bore here, but I was pretty engaged through the whole movie and just seeing how these guys play off each other. And then as you learn what's happening, I thought it was a pretty, pretty interesting concept. So yeah, if you see this kicking around for cheap, it's definitely worth picking up. It's one of the few Dollarama titles I may actually hang on to. I'd recommend seeing it. As also, if you're a Charlton Copley fan or a Aaron Richards fan, it's kind of a lesser known movie from both of them.
I actually think mine's from Dollarama too. But I have the Blu-ray, so I paid $3 for it.
Ooh.
Ooh. But yeah, is this post Apollo? It's like, did he make this before or after?
I think after.
I think so. I think Apollo was 2010.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Okay. So he basically might have learned his lesson from that movie. And
yeah, like this isn't found footage or anything. This is a straight narrative.
I'm curious about it. So I'll probably check it out eventually. But yeah, sounds pretty.
This was like, I thought for sure
you
this
thought would it was be gone. Suck?
And I was like, oh. So it's always a real surprise with Dollarama titles when that happens. Because it does not happen very often. So,
yeah. Well, I thought you would have seen the name Charlito Copley and be like, oh, fuck.
No, because I didn't mind him in Free Fire.
Right.
And I don't think I minded him in Hardcore Henry either.
Oh, okay. He's in that too.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds like
he's interesting. He's an interesting actor because I just find with him, you don't really know. He's not really typecast. You don't really know what you're going to get with that guy.
Right.
Like, he could be like a total, like, you know, yeah, you just don't really know what you're getting. And I do enjoy that about him.
All right. So Open Grave. All right. I'm going to double up because I'm going to talk about two movies with sort of similar themes. The first one is from 2007. It's a movie called Paranoid Park, directed by Gus Van Sant.
Yeah.
Based on a novel. I didn't write down the author's name, unfortunately. Blake Nelson. Blake Nelson wrote the book.
Okay.
It's the same thing. So this is basically a story about a kind of awkward skateboarding teen called Alex, played by Gabe Nevins, who lives in Portland, Oregon. He's not the best skater in the world. He's kind of, his home life is kind of eh. He just seems to be like one of those kids who drifts through life. And they end up saying, hey, let's go. His friend says, let's go to Paranoid Park, which is this like kind of undergroundy skate park in the city. So he's like, okay, we'll go check it out. He ends up going there. And then through a turn of events, he ends up accidentally killing a security guard. And so the rest of the movie is basically him kind of keeping it a secret and all the repercussions from him keeping it a secret and how it affects everything around him and himself personally. So not spoilers. This is standard stuff here. It's kind of like a coming of age slash crime drama slash Gus Van Sant movie, I guess is how you describe it, because there's a lot of like weird kind of decisions in this. Like all the skateboarding footage is shot in 16 millimeter and kind of like all over the place. And, you know, some of the tones are like up and down. Like there'll be tones where it's just like that quiet, slow burn kind of tone. And then he'll shoot to the actual moment of the security guard dying and it's so fucking intense, but then they'll go back to this unconventional structure where it's like, you know, just all over the place. Like that's what Van Sant does, like, yeah. Let's be honest. I thought this was pretty good, like not on his top levels, like not like Drugstore Cowboy or, you know, To Die For, which is a movie I put on my underrated 90s stuff. This is kind of like Gus Van Sant after being like, well, obviously Good Will Hunting. I love Good Will Hunting from him. But this is him being like, oh, fuck, I redid Psycho. It was a failure. I made one other movie in Hollywood with Finding Forrester. I'm going into more of the indie stuff because I'm more comfortable doing this. Right. So you had this. You had Last Days, which was his sort of take on Kurt Cobain. And you had Elephant at the same time. So this was... And a movie called Jerry, which I'm curious about. So this is him from like 2000 to probably 2007, making these kind of more weird, offbeat, indie kind of movies. And this one's not the top notch of those, but it's actually pretty good because it's approaching the material differently than you'd think it should, because it is unconventional and like weird shit happens. Like the way he shoots stuff is weird. The story's kind of slight, to be honest, but the kid, Gabe Nevins, he's pretty good in the lead. He's not been in a lot of stuff. And then it's the only other person of note that I wrote down was Taylor Momsen, who she plays one of his female friends. She was in a bunch of like TV shows, like forgettable TV shows, but she's actually the lead singer of a band called The Pretty Reckless.
Okay.
Who are fairly popular. So she's kind of worth mentioning just because she's in this, and she's not too bad either, but it's just like, I wish I would have liked it more, to be honest. Like, I'm not saying it was bad. I just feel like it was missing something. And I feel like Van Sant was just like, you know what? I'm just going to fucking go for it and make this movie weird and see what happens. And I know there's a lot of people who love this.
Yeah.
But just not quite what I want. I'm not a big fan of this period for him, of what I've seen, because I'm not a big fan of Last Days either, to be honest. Like, I actually think Last Days is a weaker movie than this.
Okay.
But it's pretty good for what it is.
Nice.
So, tying into that, my next film is a movie called And Then I Go from 2017, which the reason I'm tying these together is it is about teenage protagonists, but also this movie gets compared to Gus Van Sant's Elephant quite a bit online. Okay. So I've seen that happening. So this is a story about two friends, Edwin, played by Armin Darbo, and Flake, played by Sawyer Barth, who was in Super Dark Times, which I'm really curious to see. And, you know, they're like 13. They go to high school. They're always getting harassed. They're getting bullied. They're outcasts. No one really, really likes them that much. They just kind of hang out together and, you know, everyone thinks they're weird because they don't really watch TV and they don't really have cell phones, and they just kind of hang out and talk shit to each other and don't really do much, but they get bullied all the time. And that balance of the two characters actually works really good because, you know, you've got Edwin's kind of like trying to figure out who he is, but he's always going along with Flake's plans, and Flake's kind of a loose cannon in a way. Like, he's always like doing shit that's getting them in trouble, and but the other kid's just going along with it, even though he knows it's not really the right thing to be doing, but he's like, well, this is the only friend I have, so I might as well go with what he's doing.
I wonder if it's the guy from Super Dark Times that I'm thinking it is, because it's
skinny black haired kid.
No.
Okay. So, you know, eventually they come upon a plan to get revenge on all the people who are doing this to them at school. And the movie goes really dark. And if you've seen Elephant, the comparisons to Elephant with this movie, you'll know where it goes. I'm not going to say where it goes, but if you know what Elephant's about, it's kind of the same vibe.
Okay.
Okay? That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
I thought that the leads were really good. I thought Darbo and Barth were really good playing two characters who really shouldn't be friends but have no choice. That's what it felt like to me. Like,
okay, yeah.
They just had no choice because no one else wanted to be friends with them, so they ended up hooking up together. Directed by Vincent Grashaw, who handles this slow burn story really well, because this is a slow burn.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to tell you going in, this is a slow burn movie. It does not move that fast. Not a lot of stuff really happens in it. It's more just about these kids struggling through their existence. And, you know, I just thought it was a really effective movie. Like, I was on board with it through the whole thing. And when it went to the place it went, I was like, yeah, that works for me. And, you know, it just worked for me the way that it was staged. And it's a really interesting movie and, you know, really kind of timely in some ways too. So I don't want to spoil too much. That's why I'm being kind of vague. But I think my comparison...
Well, you compared it to Elephant. I mean, I think everyone knows what that means.
Well, there you go. That's I'm being vague in my own personal thing, but, you know, I compared it to Elephant.
Columbine.
Take it from what you... Take it where you're going with it, right? I didn't want to say it, but...
Yeah, but that makes me want to see it, right? I mean, yeah. I think that story's quite... I think the whole Columbine thing is quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, like a lot of movie nerds or nerds in general or whatever, can kind of relate. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it is something that would be interesting to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a really solid indie movie. And it only got on my radar because I'd been browsing on, like, I think I was browsing on Google Play, or I heard something about, I heard it mentioned on a podcast or something. And I was like, I should check out the trailer for this. And then I watched the trailer. I'm like, that's kind of my vibe. Like, this indie slow burn, you know, like, character study with dark undertones. I'm like, that's kind of my vibe. So I finally checked it out and I recommend it, especially if you're, like you said, interested in that kind of Elephant, Columbine, whatever kind of stuff, then definitely it's worth checking out. It's called And Then I Go, and yeah, recommended.
Cool. Yeah, I'll check that out for sure. Okay. Well, I decided to go into my Arrow Video box.
Nice.
And
which one? You have multiples.
I do. But I actually have never seen this movie.
All right.
So I thought I might have, but I haven't. And that's a little movie called Pray for Death.
All right. Show.
Yeah, from 1985, directed by Gordon Hessler. Of course, mainly known for a few, like, kind of older horror movies.
Yep.
And also Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Scream and Scream Again, those types of things. But he made a resurgence for himself doing ninja movies with Sho Kosugi.
Didn't he also do Nine Deaths of the Ninja?
No, he did... what's the one after this one? Pray for Death.
Rage of Honor?
No, it's the other one that Arrow put out.
Rage of Honor, I'm pretty
Rage
sure.
Rage of Honor, yeah. And then there was one more, not one of those. It was another Sho movie, but it sounded like it was more of a period piece.
Oh, okay.
Can't remember what it was called. Anyway, this was super entertaining. So we all know Sho Kosugi from the Ninja Trilogy.
Yep.
See episode whatever it was.
See episode 60-something or whatever it is.
But I had actually never seen this. I don't know why. 1985, I wasn't really up to much. But for whatever reason, I didn't see this one. And I think maybe part of what happened is I got so confused with all the ninja movies that I just maybe...
Well, all the Sho ones all had kind of similar titles, right?
So I think I might have thought I saw it, but I didn't.
Yeah, Revenge of the Ninja.
But with
Ninja
the plot 3. In this one, I actually probably did see it. Because I've seen the fucking plot a million times.
Is it Sho out for revenge?
Why? Because him and his family come to America?
And they get killed?
Something happens to one of the family members?
No way.
And then he has to go back to his ninja ways?
Get the fuck out of here.
Is that like every show movie?
Pretty much.
Well, this one, probably the next one, definitely Revenge of the Ninja.
Definitely so. Revenge of the Ninja. Actually, I don't think Nine Deaths of the Ninja is... has that plot.
See, that's another one. I think I haven't seen that.
Really?
Yeah.
That's got a pretty sweet scene with, like, kids in a school bus being held captive.
Yeah, well, it's on my list.
All right.
Okay, so Sho and his family come to America. His wife was played by Akira Kato. She hasn't done a lot, but she was the female lead in a movie I adore called The Challenge with Scott Glenn. Again, very, very unknown. Well, Kino's put this out now, so maybe a little more known, but... not many people have seen The Challenge. And if you haven't, do yourself a favor. It's Scott Glenn fucking with a samurai sword and with Akira Kato as his squeeze. And she also is also...
Isn't Frankenheimer directed it too?
Frankenheimer, yeah. It's a fucking awesome movie. But anyway, so I haven't really seen her in much. So she popped up in this. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. Because I knew I recognized her and then realized afterwards who it was. So there's these, like, they come to America, they buy this restaurant, and they decide to make it a Japanese restaurant in a kind of a shitty area of town. But meanwhile, there's these dumb gangsters that, I guess the former owner's wife died. So there's this part of the building that she used to run, like, a tea shop or something. Some weird shit.
But it's cocaine, isn't it?
But it's like he blocked off that part of the building because he didn't want to go in there for his wife because of his wife's memories. So I guess what the local mob was doing is they were like secretly going into this like abandoned part of the building and storing their drugs in there and cocaine. Doing drug deals.
Yeah, it's and, the 80s.
It was a necklace. It was a necklace that they were trying to hide for some reason. It was some sort of weird payment of something.
I'm actually surprised it wasn't like statues filled with coke. Like
no, that's Revenge of the Ninja.
They all blend together.
But it was this weird necklace and then like... a dirty cop like steals a necklace, but what that does is it makes the local gang think it was Sho and his family that have the necklace. So then they're mad at Sho's family and start to create shit. The two children are Sho's actual children, the return of Kane Kasugi from Revenge of the Ninja and his other son, Shane, Kane and Shane.
I didn't know Shane was in stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, what happens next is the dumb gangsters then go and kill the old owner for the necklace. You know, and it's kind of like they search him, don't find the necklace, but it's such a stupid scene because he's got this like the old owner's driving out of town with his car loaded up and they search him to see if he's got the necklace on him and they realize he doesn't have it on him. So they kill him. And then torch his car. And all I was thinking is, like, you dumb gangsters, like, don't you think maybe if he had the necklace, it might be packed in one of those suitcases? But you just torched the whole thing. So instead, they just jump to the conclusion that Sho Kasugi has the necklace. Don't really know why, but I've kind of lost respect for these guys, like, from an intelligence perspective. They then, like, go and kidnap one of Sho's kids after he has a fight with a local youth gang. This is they kidnap Shane, but Kane's the one who does all the fighting, like in Revenge of the Ninja. Then Sho like goes and saves him, but then he has to like start to revert to his ninja ways. Then the wife and kid get run over. Wife ends up in the hospital.
Wow.
Okay, then this is when this starts going off the rails. So then. After they're put in the hospital, Sho's starting to like really get into ninja mode now, really want revenge. He goes and does a boat raid, and he goes and raids like where the gangsters are having a party, but he has to have this big battle scene through like an abandoned ship, which I thought was weird. And then it just came making me think, man, that must have been really cool in the 80s where you could just like rent a fucking boat, like a giant ship, and like have fight scenes in it. Then I thought, oh, it'd be really fun to like walk around in one of those ships. Then I was like, oh, it would have been really fun to be an extra in this movie. So my mind was all over the place in this. But the fight scene was still pretty cool. Okay, then the gangster guy played by James Booth, who also wrote this movie. He's been in a bunch of stuff, but
he wrote Avenging Force.
Oh, did he?
The Dudikoff movie.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Fuck yeah.
So he's the main gangster, Limehouse Willie, in this. So what he does after the boat raid is he gets mad. He gets mad at Sho, and he's like, fuck you, Sho. So he slits his own wrists to get put into the hospital so he can, like, fuck shit up. And I'm thinking, why wouldn't you just... Again, dumb gangster. Like, why wouldn't you just go to the hospital? Like, why do you have to...
Just walk in.
Why would you slit your wrist so you could become a patient to, like, fuck people up? Like, why not just walk in there brazenly? Like, that's what most gangsters do. Anyway, maybe he was being really smart, but I just thought he was
being
stupid.
Maybe he just didn't want a criminal record.
Well, then I'm like, you slit your wrist. Like, that must hurt. Like, how are you going to get anything done?
He knows no pain.
He didn't seem to.
He's a bad guy.
Okay, so then he goes and, like, he goes and basically implied rapes Sho's wife, who's confined to a hospital bed, unable to move, which was really fucked up. And then he kills her. So now Sho's just fucking really mad. He goes and tries to kill the kid as well. So this guy's a real, like, kind of gross, sleazy, weird faced looking guy. And so Sho is, like, really mad now. So he, like, this 80s song comes on, like an 80s rock song. And I'm like, well, Sho wouldn't be listening to this shit, but he was in the movie. And then he, like, fucking forges a sword in, like, his, like, we're in the place where he's hiding out. And I'm like, where did he get that fucking anvil from? Like, he's got a full anvil. And then I'm like, could Sho carry the anvil? So, like, this is one of these movies that just made me really, my mind just kept out.
I think you're putting too much logic into a ninja movie.
I had so many questions throughout this movie. Like, but it was making me think a lot. Kept me awake. I was, like, thinking stuff all the time. Like, how did he get in this factory? Like, what's he doing there? Then meanwhile, Kane is, like, looking at this bike, and it gets revealed that he's, like, tricked out this bike so it, like, it's like a bike that, like, has, like, a smoke screen and like blades
like
that come out the side and shit. It's a BMX. It's fucking awesome. And I'm like, oh my god, this movie is really fun. So he beats up the thugs, and then it ends in a big finale in, like, of all places, a mannequin factory / wood shop.
Makes sense.
So this movie was crazy. So I love this. I mean, this is I don't know if I'm selling this enough, but this is up there. This is up there with Revenge of the Ninja.
No,
this is really, this was really good. And it doesn't sound like you remember some of this
stuff. I don't remember it.
So maybe you haven't seen this
either.
Maybe
not.
Maybe you think you have, but you haven't.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I have this Blu-ray too.
Yeah. So, like, let's recap. Shokasugi.
Yes.
80s.
Yes.
Girl from the Challenge.
Yes.
Kane Kasugi fighting street gangs.
Yes.
Dumb criminals. Oh, he's also got a wicked helmet with a throwing star on the front. Wicked helmet with throwing star on front.
I definitely don't remember that.
Weird hospital scene. Gangster slits wrists. Tricked out bike. Wood shop. Mannequin factory. Chick from the Challenge.
Sold.
Yeah. Oh, 80s song. And anvil. Yeah.
But the anvil was forged in fire.
No. The anvil was in the fucking room. Like, he was just... Him and the kids hide out in this place, and then next thing you know, there's a fucking anvil there.
But dude,
and he's heating up the metal and smashing it with a hammer on the anvil. And I'm like, I didn't know Sho was so talented. He's making a sword.
But dude, it's possible. Anything's possible in 80s action movies. A fucking pommel horse showed up in the Village of the Crazies in Gymkhana, okay? Fucking an anvil can show up in a room. It's possible.
It was awesome. It was awesome. It was really good. Also, we have the only other notable actor is Norman Burton shows up in this. Again, being a big Bond fan, he was Felix Leiter in Diamonds Are Forever. He's the police lieutenant who just sort of lets Sho do whatever he wants. But yeah, a lot of fun. Just, you know, be warned that the villain in this is particularly sleazy, particularly in that hospital scene. But aside from that, I mean, this is Sho top of his game. So that's Pray for Death.
I might have to watch that shit now.
You better.
I better.
You love show. I can't believe you would remember this stuff.
I don't remember it.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen Rage of Honor.
I know. This is what happened.
Holy fuck. There was so much.
I don't even know if I've seen Rage of Honor now.
There was so much awesome show in the 80s that maybe it all blended together.
But there
together.
Wasn't that many. There was only like seven movies.
Yeah, but they all fucking blended together because they all had the same plot. I have to watch it. Fuck. I guess I'll have to bust out my Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try and watch it for next episode. We'll see what happens. Might as well keep the ridiculous action movies going and talk about 1998's Black Dog. Might as well do that shit.
Oh, my God.
What?
Okay, this is really weird. Okay, I got the Google Home.
Uh-huh.
This is so random. This is so random. One of the questions I asked Google Home was, who starred in the movie Black Dog? And I don't even know why. And this is unrelated to this. Like, I had no idea. But for some reason, I wanted to know who was in the movie Black Dog.
I'll tell you who's in the fucking movie Black Dog. It's Patrick fucking Swayze. That's who's in the movie Black Dog. It's Patrick Swayze playing Jack Cruz. How fucking awesome a trucker name is Jack Cruz?
It's pretty awesome.
I mean, come on. He's fucking cruising in his 18 wheels of fucking death. Okay, so directed by Kevin Hooks, who us action fans might know for 1992's Passenger 57. You ever play roulette, Josh? Always bet on black. But so this is the kind of movie where if you're longing for like those 70s trucker movies, Black Dog's got you covered for the most part. Because this is like, this opens with a truck being chased by cop cars, just smashing through everything in its path. It fucking smashes through cars. It smashes through a fucking fruit stand. It smashes through everything. Then it fucking blows up instantly.
Nice.
Because that's what happens. And, you know, he's smuggling guns. Uh-oh.
Is this Swayze?
No. This is just the opening scene. So it turns out this trucker's smuggling guns. So into the picture comes Mr. Jack Cruz, a.k.a. the Swayze Man. Now, he's an ex-con, he's an ex-trucker, and he doesn't have a license. But his boss is like, hey, I want you to deliver this truck for me, and then, you know, I'll pay you like $10,000. Well, that's pretty fucking convenient because Swayze owes $9,000 on his mortgage or he'll lose his house.
Oh, that's pretty fucking convenient.
But he's smuggling guns. Swayze is smuggling guns, man. He doesn't agree with it. He doesn't know it, but he's going to do it anyway. So he heads down south, teams up, meets up with this religious coupon clipping bad guy played by Meatloaf.
Yeah.
And then he gets a sidekick played by Randy Travis, the country singer. And they hit the fucking road to deliver these guns. Now, while they're doing this, we have an FBI agent played by Charles S. Dutton and an ATF agent played by Stephen Tobolowsky watching their progress and arguing with each other. It doesn't have that much to do with the movie till later, but it's pretty great because they play off each other really well. And Tobolowsky is fucking awesome.
Really?
Because all he's doing in this movie is just like...
Said no one ever.
Like super... he's actually a really good character actor.
Yeah, I know he is.
I think he passed away like recently.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I think sometime in the last 6 months.
Mm.
But he just has this dry sense of humor to him, and he's always like making sarcastic comments at Dutton's FBI agent. So I'm like laughing to myself anytime they're on screen. But then I'm like, where's Jack Cruz, motherfucker? Bring me back Jack Cruz. They do. And he's getting chased by Meatloaf and his henchmen because they don't want the guns to get to where they have to be. And, you know, we've got like fucking, they're being chased. They're being boxed in by all these other truckers who Meatloaf has hired to try and run them off the road. And he's like slamming into them, and they're fucking, every time they hit something, they just fucking explode into a ball of flames every fucking time, because that's real life. You're driving your car down the street, you fucking hit someone's bumper, you fucking burst into a ball of flames. That's just how this shit goes. So he's doing that, you know? Meanwhile, he's also having these fucking nightmare sequences straight out of a horror movie where he sees this fucking black dog running towards him down the street before he fucking crashes his 18-wheeler and wakes up in a pool of sweat. You know, this is pretty great, man. This is pretty great. So, you know, I just love these action movies where you can just, like, a butterfly could land on a car and it would explode.
Yeah.
That's what Black Dog is. It's like, everything's fucking blowing up.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it makes sense if it's going to blow up. It's fucking blowing up.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking CG flames blowing up. I'm talking they really blew this fucking shit up when they were filming the movie. Like, I'm like, this is a dangerous set to be on.
Yeah.
Because everything's fucking blowing up. I can't stress enough that everything fucking blows up. Like, seriously. If I haven't sold you, everything blows up. So, I mean, Meatloaf is great.
Yeah.
Because he's just like quoting Bible passages and clipping coupons, but he's not in it quite enough for my liking, to be honest.
Mm.
But, you know, they had to add in the fact that Swayze's wife and daughter get kidnapped too. Because, you know, it's not enough that he's being fucking driven off the road and everything's exploding around him. He's got to try and save his kidnapped fucking wife and kid. So, you know, let's add that to the picture too. And, you know, ends with a somewhat typical showdown on the docks, on a fucking boat and shit, much like the movie you just talked about.
There was always boats in these movies.
I know. Like, fuck, where
did all the boats go?
I don't know. Like, are these decommissioned fucking, like, battleships and shit? Like, what is this shit?
Is it like the Under Siege boat over and over again?
Maybe.
Maybe there was just one boat in L.A. and they
Wasn't there even a fucking boat in Whitefire from last week?
Was there a boat in... No, I don't think there was a boat.
Oh, it was just on the docks.
Yeah.
Okay, but fucking boats.
There was a lot of boats.
Yeah. Like fucking, yeah, Under Siege, you're right.
People were always going on big boats.
Well, even the end of fucking...
There was a boat at Whitefire, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a fight. Ginty on the boat.
Exactly.
And then they went to the docks.
Fucking boats. Boats and fucking explosions, okay? So, this is just a ridiculous fucking movie, okay? Swayze, when he's in his action mode, we're talking like Roadhouse and shit like that. Solid hero. He doesn't have as much fun with this. He doesn't crack jokes or whatever. He's pretty serious for the most part. But, you know, he knows how to drive that fucking rig. And he knows how to make shit explode.
Yeah.
And that's all I want from my movie. And in that sense, Black Dog delivers, okay? I know this movie was a bomb, and I know people don't like it, but fuck, I was entertained for that 89 minutes. I was like, oh shit, what's going to fucking blow up next? I'm stressing this one last fucking time before I move on. Everything fucking explodes. Sold.
This is a sign, man. Like, there's no way Black Dog has come up twice in the last week for me. Once on my own accord for no fucking reason, and now you're bringing it up.
Well,
I'm destined to see this.
The entire time I'm wondering, what the fuck is the title of this movie got to do with anything? So I did a little bit of diving, and it refers to this urban legend that truckers have about where if you like start falling asleep on the road or something and something bad is going to happen, the Black Dog shows up.
Oh.
To like kind of like, you know, seal your fate. Like it runs down the middle of the road and jumps at you, and then something bad happens because you're falling asleep at the wheel or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
And that's what the title is. I'm like, huh. I was like, I just thought Black Dog was the name of a fucking rig or something, but yeah. And I'm like, fucking drive that Black Dog through shit. Make fucking shit explode. I'm in. So it's pretty fun. It's pretty fun.
Nice.
So two pretty ridiculous fun action movies back to back.
No kidding.
So how many do you got left?
I have four.
I have five, so do one and then I'll double up on my next one.
Okay.
No, or should I just keep going?
Well,
we didn't do the math, people.
I don't know. Why don't you do another one?
All right, I'll do another one. I might as well get this one out of the way.
Wait, will that work?
Yeah, because then we'll both be down to four. Because I have five.
Yeah, but then if I do one and you do one. I'm going to do one. I'm going to do
one. Okay, do it. Fuck it. We'll wing it. We'll
fucking wing it. It'll be easier to figure out when there's less numbers.
We'll wing it. Sorry, people. I know this is really fucking, like, really engrossing for you right now.
We are pros.
We're pros. We plan this shit out in advance.
Okay.
Sadly, we actually usually do.
I decided to return to the land of Jess Franco.
Oh.
And I just kind of picked the one. I was digging through my boxes, and I'm like, oh, there's this movie. And then I was digging through another box, and I'm like, oh, there's this movie again on DVD.
Oh, it's the same fucking movie. Oh,
they're both not open. Okay, well, I better watch it so I can sell one of them.
Same movie? Two times.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you don't catalog your collection, folks.
Yep. But the irony is that I do catalog my collection, and these are both in there. Whoops. Okay. This is a movie called Nightmares Come at Night from 1972.
Makes sense. Nightmares come at night.
That's when they come.
Yeah. Unless you have a nap in the middle of the day and you have a nightmare about a black dog.
Yep.
Okay.
That would be a daymare.
I guess so.
That's a thing, right?
Is there a thing called a daymare?
What if you have a nightmare when you're having a daydream? Daymare. Okay. It is now.
But, okay, never mind. I'm not. No.
It's got to be a word.
A daymare and a nightmare? What if you have, like, a nightmare, like, first thing in the morning, though? Is that a, like, early morning mare?
No, that would be a nightmare still.
That's a daymare.
No, because it's the nighttime.
Oh, fuck. Okay, go on.
But you're waking up from your nighttime rest period.
I guess. Okay.
So it'd be a nightmare.
Okay.
It's when you're resting at night. But if you were, like, snoozing during the day.
Have you ever had a daymare?
I don't know.
You ever had a nap and you had a nightmare? Or a daymare?
I don't think I've had a nightmare or a daymare and a nap. Hmm.
I think we watch too much fucked up shit to have nightmares.
I have nightmares.
Really?
But they're not like monster nightmares.
Oh, they're just like regular, like...
They're more like just fucking depressing.
They're just like someone walking into a room and saying, you're going to die in a week or something.
No, it's
like
not. It's not usually, those kind? They're just, it's just more depressing shit.
Okay, anyway, how about Jess Franco? What's his nightmares about?
It's not his. It's Anna's.
Okay.
The protagonist. She has sexy, violent dreams.
Hmm.
And then wakes up with blood on her hands, that type of stuff.
Hmm.
So she has, yeah, exactly that. She has dreams where she's fucking.
Excuse me, they're sexy, violent dreams? I want you to call them that from now on.
You know, I've seen so much, like, I'm starting to really, because I'm really trying to delve into the world of Franco to understand. And, you know, I am starting to see some themes. So one of them is dreams, dream logic. People in dreams waking up and having done something wrong. So that's what this... Okay, so just a bit of history on this movie. So this movie is a movie that was supposedly lost. Apparently it played one theater in Belgium back in the 70s and then was lost till the 90s. Like, just vanished. It never got a proper release. Never came out on VHS. Shriek Show picked it up and put it out. So I've also, I'm trying to kind of understand what the deal was here, but it also sounds like he maybe patched together two different movies. I've heard, there's differing theories on what happened with this movie, but it kind of feels like that. I'll get to that in a second. Unfortunately, I watched the Kino or the Redemption Blu-ray, and there's a Tim Lucas commentary on there that unfortunately I didn't have time to listen to before, but I'm sure a lot of this is revealed in there. But it did seem kind of, well, like a lot of Franco movies, it did seem kind of, it was a little difficult to follow, not a lot happens, and then you're kind of like, at the end, you're kind of like, what the hell was that, right? This one, even more so than normal. So the main premise is this: Anna works, is having these dreams. There's a doctor played by Paul Mueller, who's been in tons of Franco movies. He thinks she's crazy, but he's trying to help her. as he's helping her, you know, she's explaining what happened and how she got to where she is. And then, of course, we have like really long fucking flashbacks. And the whole first hour of this, you're just kind of like, what's happening? But you're not, it's a Franco movie. So you're not like, what's happening? I can't keep up. You're just like, whoa, what's happening, man? Like, you're just like, it's like you just did drugs and are just like looking at this going, whoa, like where what's happened? Like, where, why is that woman like, whoa, the striptease is like going on for 10 minutes.
You're like, and I'm asking myself almost as many questions as I did during Pray for Death right now.
Yeah. Like, is she, yeah. Like why is she taking so long to take off her clothes? Cause there's literally a 10 minute striptease in this.
Yep. That's a Franco movie. All
and
right.
It's just going on and on and on. And then in some parts of it, like Soledad Miranda, like Franco's muse at the time, she shows up, but she's like showing up in scenes that are completely unrelated to the other plot. But then they kind of sort of become kind of related later on. So it's a lot of the Franco movies are like this, and you're just kind of really not knowing what's happening. But for some reason, they're like oddly compelling. Now, I think a lot of it, as a male, I think a lot of it is because, like, Diana Loris, who plays Anna in this movie, literally has clothes on for maybe 10% of the time. She's naked throughout the rest of the movie. So that always helps, right? Same with Colette Giacobbe, who plays Cynthia, who's this her, like, lesbian lover who she's living with. Also naked often. So that really helps keep things going. But I just also think just the whole vibe and just kind of what Franco's doing, somehow, even though there's nothing going on, there's nothing to really even follow, you're not really invested in the characters. But for some reason, you want to keep watching. And that's what happened with this one. And I don't get it, but I do get, I'm really starting to get why people are really into this guy. Because there is a certain thing about Franco movies that once you kind of overcome it, like you really do are pretty compelled. But not the best filmmaking. Although this one, I do think, sorry, not the best storytelling. I'll put it that way. But this one does have like a real kind of style to it. And, you know, the cinematography in this one was noticeably good. The costumes were great to look at. I mean, it just had, there's something going on here. And he really knew how to choose his ladies too. Like they were always, at least the ones, Soledad Miranda, the characters in this one, even Lena Romay, I do find that you're pretty drawn to them. Not just because they're naked. I mean, they're just very unique people. And I think you'd have to be working with Jess Franco, especially in this time period. So I found this to be really interesting. Now, as far as like what would I give it, I'd give this probably like a 2 out of 5. Like this isn't a great movie, but there is something about it that I certainly see people being drawn to. Diane Loris was in, she's been in tons of stuff, most notably one of his first movies, Awful Dr. Orloff, maybe his first movie, and The Fangs of the Living Dead. Colette was in Eugenie and Count Dracula. There's a whole bunch of people from Franco's Count Dracula were in this movie. Jack Taylor shows up. He's another Franco regular. He's playing the lover of Anna's lesbian roommate. But I guess she's not really a lesbian because she has a male lover. Whatever. And then there's these weird neighbors. And like Soledad Miranda, like I just don't understand. She's like such an icon of Eurotrash. But she literally does fucking nothing in this. There's this like, they cut to these neighbors. It's her and her boyfriend a few times, and it's mainly Soledad Miranda lying on her stomach on a bed or something with no clothes on. So it's basic, and it's a shot from the back. So you're just looking at Soledad Miranda's ass. She's not really doing anything, and I'm kind of like, she was kind of like a star, at least as far as Franco goes at this point. Not really sure why she has this like bit part, but the best is when they're showing her and then they pan up and on the wall in like really crude graffiti is written, "Life is all shit." Like for no reason. It's a pretty classic scene, but anyway, I'm not really sure what I think of this one. I mean, I think if you're looking for an entertaining Franco movie, there's a lot more better ones out there.
Yeah, Faceless Bloody Moon.
Yeah, but as far as this, like, kind of like the Franco Dream Logic, I mean, this is one I'm kind of glad I own. I think I will go back to it and check it out again just because it was so, like, so weird. But definitely not for the Franco novice. You're going to be like, what the fuck is going on?
I've always had a hard time with him.
Yeah.
He's not really my thing. And even you describing this, I'm like, that's not really my thing.
Yeah, and it's not really my thing either. But as I'm, because I'm really trying to understand, because I know Vince really loves Jess Franco, mm-hmm. And a lot of people do. I mean, Tim Lucas is so into this guy. And I love, like, I really respect Tim Lucas from Video Watchdog. So I'm really trying. And as I watch more, I am starting to get it, like, for sure. But this would probably be one of the more unaccessible titles.
Yeah, like I like the ones I mentioned, like Bloody Moon, Faceless. I like both of those movies. I actually don't mind his Jack the Ripper movie he made with Kinski.
Yeah.
With Klaus Kinski, and Orloff is pretty good. But more of these kind of like soft focus, semi-erotica, dreamy kind of stuff I have a hard time with. I'm the same way with Jean Rollin, where he does this sort of similar stuff, and I just, it's not my thing personally.
Yeah, I mean, and I did like this more than like that Marquise de Sade, you know, because that one was just felt pretty much like a porn, right? And this, you know, this felt a bit more like more erotic. So I mean, I just, yeah, that was like a little much. I was just like, what the fuck am I wasting my time really watching this for, other than, yeah, like, can't even say Lena Romay's performance, but yeah. Anyway, it's interesting. I'm curious to keep diving into the world of Franco and sort of seeing what happens. But this would definitely not be my first choice if I was recommending a Franco movie to you.
So all right,
Nightmares Come at Night.
Nightmares Come at Night. I think you have three.
Yeah.
We gotta do some math here, folks.
No, just go ahead. Do another one.
One, two, three. I'm gonna do a two-y.
Okay.
First one's gonna be super fast because it's one you've talked about recently, and that's Jackals from 2017.
Oh, yeah.
I think was it last episode you talked about it,
or might
the
have
one
been,
before?
Yeah.
You know, directed by Kevin Grootert, who made the Saw sequel, a couple of the Saw sequels,
yeah,
and written by Jared Reveille, who apparently wrote this script in 2006 originally, which you can kind of tell, admittedly. This is just your basic, like Josh has mentioned, you know, it's kind of like a home invasion movie with a mild twist, because it's about a family who kind of kidnapped their son from this cult so he can be deprogrammed by Stephen Dorff's Semper Fi Marine type character in their cabin in the woods. And the cult doesn't take too kindly to that and decide to come and get back their member and, you know, decide they'll kill anyone who gets in their way, basically. And this is not a movie that I really liked,
to
be completely honest with you. I liked the idea of it. Like, I liked the whole cult deprogramming stuff and all that. I liked that idea, but I don't feel like this had enough of that. I feel like it just decided to tread its way into your next, the stranger's kind of territory, not really giving your cult any real personality. Like, just having people standing around in the fog wearing animal masks doesn't do a hell of a lot for me, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I found the stuff inside the house with Stephen Dorff's character kind of like, you know, harassing the kidnapped, you know, kid he's trying to convert a lot more interesting.
Me too. Yeah.
Because I found that stuff to be more like, you know, like, oh, you're basically, you know, poking at him to try and make him, you know, get out this aggression, but also show you that he's
human. Yeah.
Like, trying to get the logic, like, you know, do you understand why your family doesn't want you in this? Like, doesn't make sense, right? So that stuff's pretty good. But it's just like, that stuff's very small portion of this movie.
Yeah.
And it's forgotten about after about half an hour. And then it just becomes a standard home invasion, boring tropes kind of deal that doesn't really go anywhere and ends abruptly. And I just, it wasn't doing anything for me. Let's be honest. Like, yeah. it was just people standing with fog behind them. And every once in a while they'd come to the door and try and get in. And the fucking family did such stupid shit in this movie through the entire thing. It's like, okay, I get you're a dysfunctional family. I get that you want to save your kid, but you know, if you have people starting to invade your house and everything, you don't fucking stand by a window so they can stick their arm through a fucking window to grab you, you know? You don't do shit like that. You don't go outside and do dumb shit. Like, you just don't do that. You don't go stand outside and wait for everyone to pretty much fucking surround you before you, like, get back in the house and lock the door. You don't do that shit. And I'm really wondering how they were so fucking smart that they could make all these fucking makeshift weapons out of nothing. Like, I got a stick. I'm going to tape a knife to it. Look at me go. I've made a weapon. I'm like, no. Like, who thinks of that shit?
Yeah.
I wouldn't think of that shit. I wouldn't be like, oh, fuck, I'm going to take this fucking broom and I'm going to, like, tape four fucking knives to it so I can, like, fucking swing it around fucking ninja style.
Yeah, I wouldn't think of it.
I wouldn't think of that shit. I'd just be like, hey, I got this butcher knife. Here I go.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on.
Like, well, now you might, though.
No, I wouldn't, because it's illogical. It's fucking... It's a burden. Like, it's, like, fucking so awkward to move. You're fucking trying to hit him with this fucking knife... fucking pointed stick, and they're just gonna grab the fucking stick and be like, ha ha ha, and snap it over their knee.
Yeah,
at least if you get them in close with a fucking butcher knife, like, hey, guess what, twist in your nut in your guts, ha ha ha, I got you, you fucker. No, like, no, I didn't like that. And like, apart from the baddies having this mob mentality, they had no personality whatsoever in this movie. Even the main bad guy, it's like, ooh, he's got a different mask than everyone else, but no personality because we don't know who the fuck he is.
Yeah.
Like, there's no background on this cult particularly, right? And I'm just like, that's kind of disappointing because...
Well, and like, what's the draw?
Exactly.
Like, why does the family member want to be in the cult?
Yeah, and like, why do the cult want him back so badly when all he's done is blather stupid bullshit at us the entire time, right? Yeah. Like I don't get it. Like, that needs fleshing out.
Yeah.
You know, don't be copying your next and the strangers. Flesh out your fucking story about the cult, you know?
Yeah.
This is an 85 fucking minute movie. Maybe you're trying to do too much of an ambitious story for an 85-minute movie, obviously, because you can't even fucking end it properly.
Yeah.
You know? And then on top of that, the opening scene, which is a POV, Halloween-inspired kind of opening scene set, like, that's okay. Like, I didn't mind that. I was like, that's pretty good. It's shot well. It's nothing new, but, you know, it's shot well. It's got pretty good mood. You know, it's got, like, a pretty good payoff. Then I read after I've seen the movie that it was added on later. Like, it wasn't actually part of the movie. It was just like a kind of like a stinger to kick the movie off properly.
It didn't feel like part of the movie.
Well, exactly. It felt like
it had nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
They just had the guy putting on the animal mask and seeing his reflection in a mirror.
Yeah.
And being like, oh, he's a member of the cult.
Yeah.
But really, those characters had nothing to do with the rest of the movie. I mean, pretty good sequence.
Yeah.
But doesn't belong in this movie.
No.
You know, like, if you want a stinger, do your second stinger you did, where the kidnapping scene, where they pull up with the van and kidnap them.
Yeah.
That's a stinger because you didn't know what was going on at first.
Yeah.
Start with something like that. Like, are you padding your movie with this POV? Because you're like, oh shit, I got a 75-minute movie without this opening scene we're going to go back and shoot.
Yeah.
Like, it was just not very good. Like... It was released by Scream Factory. Like, I think this was like, I don't know if this was an original production or a pickup.
I think it was a pickup.
But it's like, it just doesn't work on so many levels. It's just, you know, it tries. It tries to have mood. It tries to have suspense. And it's just, I don't care.
Yeah.
That's the problem. I don't care about the family particularly. I cared when you were doing the cult stuff, like in the opening scenes when they have him in the house and he's like calling them little piggies and like laughing at them and everything, and they're getting upset that it's not their son, like it's not my son or my brother or my boyfriend that I recognize.
Yeah,
that stuff I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. But then when it just becomes a standard home invasion bullshit, I'm like, no. And then the fact that you're so fucking lazy that you haven't even taken the time to even develop your villains at all. Having an image of your villains, great. But having no personality behind those villains, not great.
Yeah.
And that's where Jackals fails.
Yeah, I agree. It was one of those movies that, and actually I actually didn't care about this movie. Then I kind of found out what the premise was and got excited, and I actually was like, oh, this is going to be really good. And now I'm back to not caring again.
That, I'm exactly like you.
Yeah.
Where I was like, okay, they're releasing this movie. And then I'm like, ooh, culty programming.
Yeah.
Like, that'd be cool. Because there's not many movies about that. Yeah. There's like Split Image from 1982. It's the only one I can think of.
Yeah.
And then they watch the movie. I'm like, okay, you did nothing with that. You brought a pretty cool idea to the table, but you did nothing with it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it not recommended.
Yeah, agreed.
So.
Yeah.
Should I do another one?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to do another one because I've got another horror movie, so I might as well tie her up. Guess what I watched, Josh?
Caligula. Oh, no, it's a horror movie.
No.
House.
Nope. But I continued my journey into the land of sequels.
Oh, fuck me. Really?
Yeah, I watched Children of the Corn, The Gathering.
Oh.
From 1996.
This can't have lived up to the last one.
It does not. In any way, shape, or form.
Are they back to the corn?
Yes.
Oh.
So this is from 1996. This was the first actual movie that Dimension produced as part of the series.
Okay.
Because part three they released, but they didn't produce it. So by this time, Dimension Pictures, they were doing all these, like, The Prophecy and Mimic and all these horror movies. And they had all the Hellraiser sequels. And I think they just cranked these out to keep the license, to be honest with you. I know that's what they did at the end when they did the Hellraiser Judgment and that Children of the Corn. There was a new Children of the Corn.
Was it worth it, Dimension?
Probably not, because, like, people see a new Children of the Corn title, like, oh, fuck, here we go.
Yeah.
So this is the fourth entry. This opens with Karen Black answering the door to her house and letting a kid in, and the kid fucking melts down. Like, he starts bleeding from his eyes and all this stuff. He looks like,
okay, pretty like a promising opening.
Pretty cool, but a nightmare sequence.
Ah.
So bye-bye promise.
Good old nightmare sequence.
Good old nightmare sequence. So, and then into the picture comes Naomi Watts.
Whoa.
Playing Karen Black's daughter. Now, this is like around the time she did this, and she did Down, a.k.a. The Shaft, a couple years later.
For what Dick year Moss. Was this?
96.
So, like, Tank Girl era.
Yeah, and Down's 98. So, yeah. I was actually quite surprised to see her in this, because I didn't realize she was in it.
Yeah.
Like, hey, Naomi Watts, fuck. She's a legit actress in this movie. I'm like, okay. I'm like, why am I thinking Karen Black's not a legit actress? Oh, that's right, because she did a whole bunch of shit in the 80s and the 90s, right? That's why I don't think she's legit. Yeah, but
she was in Five Easy Pieces.
I know, but she was in good stuff. I'm not saying she wasn't, but the 80s and 90s is a fucking Karen Black wasteland.
Yeah. She was in Reuben and Ed.
Yeah, but she was also in fucking, like, Evil Spirits. Yeah. You know, no,
she had it was a rough time.
So Naomi Watts shows up. She's the daughter. It's Grand Island, Nebraska this time. It's not Gatlin. And she returns home, finds out her mom's agoraphobic and a little bit nutty, ends up finding out that all the kids in town are, you know, a little bit nutty too, because they're caught up in this corn cult again. Never really explained why they're caught up in this corn cult. It just fucking happens. And, you know, you got, like, the typical throwaway characters being killed, like the dumbass drunk climbing under the machinery who gets, you know, speared and, you know, parts of his body cut off. And I'm like, that's okay, I guess. All the kids in town get this fever, which also makes them turn on their parents. And it turns out, Josh, it's actually the plotting of a demonic kid who is, like, I guess supposed to be he who walks behind the rose in kid form. It doesn't make a whole lot of fucking sense. It really doesn't. We've got, like, you know, we've got a bit of sharp object trauma. We've got, like, we're sitting there watching the movie going, Karen Black really doesn't have any purpose in this movie, because she shows up every 15 minutes to be like a shitty mom who Naomi Watts has to look after. We've got a guy being cut in half by a fucking hospital gurney, which makes no fucking sense to me whatsoever.
No.
Like, the hospital gurney's coming towards him, and a fucking metal blade springs out at the end and chops him in half.
That's kind of cool.
It's not cool.
That is kind of cool.
It's a Children of the Corn movie. Why do it? Who's equipping these gurneys with a fucking pop-out blade? No. Piles on backstory that makes no fucking sense, has a few impalements on its way, and stupidly, there's a fucking part in this where they decide that the only way they can kill this demonic kid is mercury bullets. And I'm sitting there going, he's not a fucking werewolf, people. He's a fucking Children of the Corn. Just chop his goddamn fucking head off and be done with it. Like, come on. You got fucking scythes hanging around everywhere. You got all these fucking farm implements. Put them to good fucking use and end this fucking movie and put me out of my misery. Like, seriously, just get it over with.
I'm trying to think of the number of swears in the last minute.
Too many. So after part three, I was like on this, like this Children of the Corn, like, oh yeah, it's part three. It's so entertaining. Then this comes along and I'm like, you're taking 40 steps back, Children of the Corn. You took it out of the country. You put it in the city. You had fucking monster effects. You had people being killed everywhere. What are you going to do? You're going to throw me back in the middle of buttfuck nowhere and bore me to tears again. Thanks. Thanks for that, Children of the Corn. So, yeah. Directed by Greg Spence, who only did The Prophecy 2 as well for Dimension, but apparently is a producer on Game of Thrones now. So, hey, that's something. But I'm really like, why is Naomi Watts in this?
I am like in awe right now.
What?
Like, I could never do this.
What?
This is a franchise I could never do this with. Like, this is the franchise where I've always like, back in the day when I perused the aisles of my video store.
You're like, nope.
It was really the one where I was like, who rents that? Like, who has really gone through the first six and is actually renting that new one that came out? And even you were, no, you weren't that guy.
I've seen up to part five, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, I tip my hat to you because I could, this is one friend. Because the first one I thought was lame.
Yeah,
like,
I
could never keep going. Like, God.
Well, this is pretty miserable, pretty weak shit. Couple of blood moments, they're okay, but like the story is so fucking dumb.
Yeah,
like, oh, I'm a demonic kid. I've given everyone fevers. Now they're gonna kill their parents. I'm like, no, and I'm like, what's the? I can understand why Karen Black is in this, but I have no idea why Naomi Watts is in this, to be honest. And I don't think it's going to get much better for me because part five is called Fields of Terror.
Ugh.
It's directed by Ethan Wiley, who wrote the House movies, but also made a really miserable, also wrote a really miserable Nature Run Amok movie called Bear in the 2000s. And it stars Alexis Arquette. So I don't have much hope for five being much better than four, but I'll let you know next episode.
Are you promising that?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
So I'm watching these so that you guys out there don't have to. I do not recommend this series.
I couldn't do it, man. This is on, like, especially I could never commit to watching one. Because this to me is like the fucking Cheech and Chong of horror. Like,
but dude, I made it through the Police Academy series. I think I can do Children of the
Corn. Okay, that's true.
I think so.
Oh my God.
But yeah, after having so much hope after Urban Harvest, my hope is gone. And I think it's just going to be a downward fucking slog from here.
Like, it must be like, is it like the Midwest Trump supporters? Like, is that who was renting these? Because it's like their thing.
I think there's some people out there who are just like, anything Stephen King's name is associated with, they're like, I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, how else can you explain the fact that there's people out there who actually admit to liking The Mangler now?
I've never seen
like,
it.
Like, there's people who admit to liking Graveyard Shift.
Ooh, yeah.
Just because Stephen King has something to do with it doesn't particularly mean it's a good movie, people.
Yeah.
And the fact that Stephen King actually allowed them to get the rights to a story that really doesn't have a lot to do with the movie series and make fucking 9 movies.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be a line somewhere. There really does.
I think there's like an annual Children of the Corn festival they have too.
Are you fucking kidding?
Like, I think so.
Like where?
Like where the original was shot. Where was it?
Gatlin is the fictional city, but I don't know where they shot it.
I think they might have shot it there or like somewhere.
You know, that's really sad.
I think there's a website.
That's
yeah.
really sad, and I feel really sorry for the people who have to go to that. Because, you know,
I don't know if it's super well attended, but
I wouldn't think so.
It's probably like the first blood tour out in Hope. Like, there's probably like 10 people show up every year, nerdy.
Maybe they like take you to the diner and they're like, here's where he put his dad's hand into the meat slicer or yeah. something. Like,
yeah.
Like, here's where Linda Hamilton looked really concerned. Here's where Peter Horton said, shut up, Linda Hamilton, and fucking get away from those children.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, come on. Like, why? I actually questioned myself during this. Why am I doing this to myself? But then I realized, well, if I get through this box set, I can at least try and sell it on eBay or something.
Oh, it's a box set.
The set I have is parts 2 through 7.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, dude.
Oh, my God.
And then I bought 8 separately because I was like, oh, I can't. Got to keep this ball rolling. It's kind of like you and your Lake Placid. You're like, I got to keep this ball rolling.
Yeah.
And then when you're in the middle of it, you're like, what the fuck am I doing right now? Yeah.
At least there was only 4 of those.
I'm like, I'm almost ready to go into my Dollarama pile after this shit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Well, just while you were talking, my mind wandered a little bit.
It doesn't take much for
sure. Because you mentioned 80s.
Yeah.
And I do want to bring up, we were remiss to mention at the beginning that we also lost John Carl Beekler in the last few weeks
yes.
as well.
Yes.
Makeup effects legend. Of course, worked with Charles Band quite a bit in a number of Full Moon movies, but he's worked on so much stuff that we love. And yep. That was another, way too young and surprising loss. So.
Director of Friday the 13th, Part 7.
Yep.
We'll always have Jason slamming a sleeping bag up against a tree to remember him by.
Yeah. So, yes, rest in peace to John Carl Beekler as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay. So I have 3 more.
Okay. I do as well.
Let's talk about this shit.
Wow.
No, good shit.
Oh, okay.
I watched The Dirt.
Oh, I was going to watch it for this episode, but I didn't get around to it.
I'm shocked you didn't watch it.
I was going to. I didn't get around to it.
I couldn't not watch it.
I'm going to watch it this week.
Okay, so I'm such a huge Motley Crue fan that, like, this came on, and yeah, last night I'm like, oh, what should I watch? And I couldn't. I just was like, I have to. I'm so excited about this. So, especially since Chris told me last time we saw each other that Jeff Tremaine directed this, because I was a little like, oh, I don't know. But then when I found out Jeff Tremaine, I mean, even though Jeff Tremaine's mainly known for doing the Jackass movies, I did think this was someone who would kind of get it and kind of get the tone they should go for. And I thought he fucking nailed it. I loved this movie. So, of course, this is the newly released docudrama about Motley Crue that was dropped on Netflix. And, yeah, this was an absolute hoot from start to finish. I didn't think there was any dull moments throughout. Loved every minute of it. Loved all the actors. It was just, just really, really solid. So it tells a story from when the band first, really starts with Nikki Sixx's childhood. But it really starts with when he started trying to form the band, how they all get together, and then it goes through their career. A lot of focus on the early days, and then it goes through, like, you know, the drugs and kind of the major events of their history. You know, the Vince Neil crash with Razzle and the Ozzy tour and Nikki Sixx's drug addiction, Heather Locklear and Tommy Lee. It does drop out the John Corabi era briefly, but it does drop out a lot of stuff too. But I mean, there's so much you could tell with this band. This band is just so iconic and has so much crazy stuff going on that really, and I kind of read this online too, that you really could have made this into a mini series, like a 10 episode series. And I really think that might have been a better way to go.
Well, even the book. There's so much crammed into that book that they couldn't possibly get it all.
Yeah, so I was actually kind of bummed after, because I enjoyed this so much. I was kind of bummed. Like, I was like, oh, this really would have been a great like 10-hour series. But yeah, it is what it is, and it's a lot of fun for what it is. It's just they have to whip through some stuff so quickly that that I just kind of felt a little bit like, darn, like, why, I wish we could have seen more of that. Like the whole Theater of Pain girls era, like, it's goes, it like almost blends into one, right? So you just don't, it has to skim over, but they'd have to in the, with what they have here. But even still, I really, really loved it. Very, very surprising cast. You've got two Brits, an Aussie, and an American. And if I had known that going in, I would have been like, yeah, right. But these guys all fucking nail it. Douglas Booth plays Nikki Six. Don't know much about this guy. He was in the Limehouse Golem. It's a horror movie, but that's really all I know him from. And I haven't even seen that. Great. He's awesome as Nikki Six. Machine Gun Kelly, a rapper, plays Tommy Lee. Again, just perfect.
Yeah, he's the one who's getting the most praise.
Yeah, he's perfectly cast. Yvonne Rion, Game of Thrones actor, plays McMars. Really liked him as well. But my favorite was Daniel Weber playing Vince Neil. I don't know if he... He reminded me a lot of Michael Starr from Steel Panther. Yeah. That's who he reminded me of, but... Michael Starr is a lot of Vince Neil, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, I get it. But I really, really liked him. Like, every scene he was in, I just was very sympathetic towards the character. But I really felt like, from reading the book and just all I know about Motley Crue, I felt like these guys really kind of captured the personalities. And one thing that makes Crue so iconic and just so fun to watch is just they do have pretty distinct personalities. And, you know, like him or not, Tommy Lee is a pretty engaging personality. Like, he's just so bouncy and all over the place, it's pretty hard not to be engaged by him. And Nikki Six, you know, a little more serious, but just, I think, a very smart dude that's gone through a lot of shit. And Vince, you know, party dude, and this guy was really great to watch. The real surprise for me was Mick Mars. I mean, Mick's always kind of been on the sideline of Motley Crue, but, you know, this is kind of the first glimpse I've kind of had into what the dynamic of that group maybe was like. Because even in The Dirt, the book, a lot of it, Mick's not really in there that much. Like, because I don't think he was that involved with all the drama. But I think he was probably kind of like the glue that kind of kept the crazy kids all together. And it really came across in this movie. So I would highly, highly, highly recommend this. I don't know if I'm going just from nostalgia and my love for the band, but I don't think so. I mean, I think if you're into rock music and if you have any idea of Motley Crue, and just that kind of energy and that kind of jackass spirit, I think you'll get a kick out of this. But I absolutely love this. So, and then I'm sad that this is it. This is all we're going to get.
Maybe I should have watched that instead of Children of the Corn.
Maybe.
I actually was trying to fit it in before we recorded, but I just didn't get a chance.
Yeah, it's great, man. I loved it.
I am going to watch it, though. I'm planning to watch it in the next week for sure.
Yeah, don't put this one off.
No, I've been waiting for it to come out on... I don't get excited about Netflix movies very often just because... I forget about them so fast, but this one I was actually like looking forward to watching, so I'll probably get it watched.
Yeah, as soon as I turned on the TV last night, because I was trying to figure out the last thing to watch, as soon as I saw it, I'm just like, I can't not watch this, you know? So
I'll probably talk about it next time, too.
Yeah, it's great.
So you've got two left, right?
I do.
Okay, so I've got it planned out. I'm going to talk about my Tubi adventures, because every once in a while I'll fire up the Tubi app and pick a movie that I haven't seen, because that app is a freaking treasure trove of B-movies. I mean, where else am I going to see Born Innocent? Like, really? And I watched Rewind This last episode, the Rewind This documentary on Tubi. This time, I watched a movie from 1994 called Jailbait.
Oh.
Now, this is also known as Streetwise. I quite prefer Jailbait more as a title, honestly. Directed by Raphael Zelinsky, who I've talked about in past episodes for directing the Police Academy ripoff Recruits. He's also the director.
Oh, that's what he did.
He's also the director of Screwballs.
Oh, okay.
And he directed a movie called Fun, which co-stars Renee Humphrey, who is in Jailbait.
Yeah.
So basically what Jailbait is, it opens with a faux ambulance abduction, as I like to call it. So it's like this girl gets picked up by an ambulance, taken to the docks, and shipped off for slavery. And then, you know, from there, we meet Kyle, played by Renee Humphrey, who's a newcomer to Hollywood. So she's like your typical, I'm from the Midwest, and I'm coming to Hollywood, and my sister's here, and I'm going to meet up with my sister, and, you know, I'm going to become a famous singer or actress. But her sister's Mercy, played by Krista Erickson, little does Kyle know, her sister is also a hooker who finds herself in trouble after one of her Johns is killed and is on the run from the police. Speaking of the police, we have a detective played by who? C. Thomas Howell.
Yeah.
And he comes into the picture to not only help find Mercy, but also to try and break down this like kind of white slavery / prostitution ring that's going on. He ends up getting kind of having Kyle come under his wing, and, you know, they have a lot of bonding moments as he looks for Mercy. And then eventually, you know, he fucks her. You know,
how old is she again?
17.
Yeah.
So I'm watching this movie and, you know, I'm like, they start making out and all in my head is like, dude, she's 17, dude.
She's only 17.
She's only 17. And I'm like, dude, no, no. And then like the saxophone kicks in and I'm like, oh fuck, they're making out to a sax solo. And I'm like, oh fuck, she's looking right at the camera. I'm like, this is really fucking awkward right now.
This was 90s, right?
94.
90s erotic thriller.
And yeah. I'm just like, no, no, this isn't happening right now. He's supposed to be like in his late 20s. She's 17 and he's having sex with her. I'm like, no, this isn't right. So I'm like, okay, well, we've got that, but, you know, at least in the meantime we've got like some silliness going on where, like, earlier in the movie Kyle ends up at this apartment and she's walking down the hall and all of a sudden there's a fucking gunfight that goes on right in front of her because she's going to her sister's apartment. And all of a sudden these guys burst out into the hallway shooting guns at each other. And she's just sitting there going, oh my God. And then she goes to leave and goes down the stairs and there's a chick getting eaten out on the stairs. And she's like, oh my God. So she goes back upstairs and falls asleep in the hallway outside her sister's apartment. This happens in this fucking movie. Like, this is like kind of like, we're going to show you the sleazy side of Hollywood, you know? You thought Vice Squad was bad. Wait till you see Jailbait, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, yeah, but it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And, you know, you got C. Thomas Howell trying to act all tough. So he's like the detective and he's like trying to talk all tough. He's like, hey, come over here. And I'm like, I'm not buying it, pony boy. I'm not fucking buying it, dude. I'm like, you were in Soul Man. I don't think I can buy you in a serious role like this ever. You know, and just like these bizarre moments, like there's a scene where Kyle's walking down the sidewalk and this girl she meets up with is like, you know, shoplifts from this shop and she runs away. And the shopkeeper comes out and he's like, they're like, whoa, she was fast. And the shopkeeper starts like fucking just tap dancing. He's like, doo, 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 doo. He goes, that's fast. And I'm like, what the hell's going on right now? Like what's happening? And it's just like, you know, and then it just kind of shambles through the story as C. Thomas Howell's character gets himself into these various situations when he's not busy boning the 17-year-old Kyle off to the side.
God.
Who's staying at his apartment now. And I'm just like, okay, the problem is it's sleazy, but it's not sleazy enough.
Yeah, was there nudity in this?
Yeah, there is.
Like much?
There's an NC-17 version that has a bit more nudity.
I just remember the 20-year-old me.
Yeah.
Like, because this is when, like, erotic thrillers were, like, all the rage.
Yeah.
And I remember being, like, disappointed by the lack of nudity.
I think the version on Tubi is the R-rated version. And there's a tiny bit of nudity, but not tons. I've actually heard the NC-17 version has quite a bit more of Renee Humphrey taking a shower and the makeout scene with like C. Thomas Howell.
Yeah, that's creepy.
But
too.
I'm just like, but how's that erotic? I know in my head that she her character is supposed to be 17.
Yeah,
and he's like a 30-year-old man.
Yeah,
like I'm not. I can't.
Maybe
get
that's it, what it was. Like it just. It was billed as one of these erotic thrillers, and there was the unrated cut.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel, like, sexy at all.
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah. It's not. It's actually kind of just a very mediocre...
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very mediocre, like, erotic thriller slash crime movie, and I'm like, I'm not upset that I watched it, but I'm really happy that I didn't pay to see it, let's put it that way. Because I'm like, I'm curious about the C. Thomas Howell 90s... when he tried to be like a action hero kind of thing. And I'm super curious to see a movie from the director of Screwballs that isn't a sex comedy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I put this on. And I'm very hesitant to recommend it simply because that whole angle of them making out creeps me the fuck out even thinking about it now. And the story's just not that compelling, really. If you want to see the sleazy side of Hollywood, Vice Squad...
Yeah.
That's all you need. You don't need Jailbait.
Or Caged Fury.
Yeah, you don't... you just don't need Jailbait. Let's just leave it at that. It's pretty mediocre. It, even for 90s erotic thrillers, there's better ones out there than this.
Yeah.
Like, there's... Night Eyes is fucking better than Jailbait. Let's just say that, even. I mean, Night Eyes has Shannon Tweed, so, you know...
Yeah, I'm not going to knock Night Eyes.
Exactly. So... Even a movie like fucking Bedroom Eyes 2, directed by Chuck Vincent, is probably better than this.
Bedroom Eyes 2.
Yeah, I had to say 2, because part 1 came out in 84, so it doesn't count. But, like, even the Shannon Worry stuff is more entertaining than Jailbait.
Yeah, it was.
Well, yeah, like...
Mind you, I don't know if those hold up
all. Those Gregory Hippolyte movies are more entertaining than Jailbait.
Yeah.
It's just very mediocre and very forgettable, and... I'm not upset that I watched it, but I think I was expecting more than I got. So, yeah, bummer.
Yeah. All right.
Sorry, not too enthusiastic.
Well, now that we sleazed it up a bit, why don't I sleaze it up a little more?
Why not?
I decided to watch Mad Dog Killer from 1977, directed by Sergio Guarico, a.k.a. Beast with a Gun, a.k.a. Ferocious. What's Mad Dog Killer, you ask? Well, if you're a Quentin Tarantino fan, Mad Dog Killer is the film that's playing in Jackie Brown, where Samuel L. Jackson says, "Is that Rutger Hauer?" And Bridget Fonda goes, "No, that's Helmut Berger." That movie that's playing is Mad Dog Killer. And there's quite an extended sequence of it in Jackie Brown. So that's the movie that this is. Another one I think I have twice because I didn't realize when I picked up the 88 Films Blu-ray, I didn't realize that this was the Beast with the Gun that Anchor Bay put out back in the day. So, yeah, same movie. Anyway, directed by Sergio
Research.
I had no idea. Anyway, directed by Sergio Guarico.
Not Richard Guarico?
No. An Italian director I don't really know anything about.
Can I just say I think Richard Guarico would have been better in Jailbait than C. Thomas Howell?
He might have been.
All right.
Especially anyway. In that time period.
Yeah, anyway.
C. Thomas Howell was okay in Payback with Joan Severance, so. But it was with Joan Severance. Anyway. And I think Robert Davi. Anyway. Back to Mad Dog Killer. Okay, so Sergio Guarico, don't really know much about him. Movie opens with a prison escape. About four prisoners break out, led by my buddy, Helmut Berger. And I love Helmut Berger. I haven't seen him in tons of movies, but in Salon Kitty and in Jess Franco's Faceless, the guy like steals the show both times. And again, in this movie, the guy just dominates the whole movie. So he's great. I really do think he was a pretty compelling actor.
Was he the mad doctor in Faceless?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. He was great.
He's awesome. Yeah. He's really great. Okay. So after the prison escape, we cut to a really great opening song. So the music in this movie really stands out. It's really synthy. It's got a really great guitar solo finale. Kind of reminded me, like, you know that 70s, 80s, like, era Tangerine Dream, that kind of proggy stuff. But, the score from Umberto Smaila is awesome. And right from the opening theme through the whole movie, I just was totally captivated by the music. Really, really noticeable. Now, a lot of the Italian movies, of course, had that with, you know, Fabio Frizzi and Goblin and all those guys. Music was a real thing, but this had a bit of a different vibe than some of their stuff. I mean, it's kind of like Goblin, I guess, a bit, but anyway, very noticeable opening theme and music in this. Then the movie is just pretty much set up with the gang led by Berger. Just these guys, him in particular, he's just a total, like, prick, and he, like, they basically, every time they walk up to someone, anytime they run into a person, it's just Helmut Berger swearing at them and, like, beating the shit out of them. Like, any person they run into. They go to a gas station, they beat the shit out of the people and swear at them. They run into someone else, they beat the shit out of them. So the guy's just a real kind of sleazy kind of jerk. And then it culminates in they go to track down the informant that put them in jail. So they get this guy, they bring him out to, and his girlfriend, they bring them out to this, like, kind of like rock quarry type place. And then Helmut Berger proceeds to rape the guy's girlfriend in front of him. And then they proceed to beat the shit out of the guy and throw him in a grave and buried alive, and then cover him with lime. And it's just a pretty nasty scene. So this is a pretty nasty movie. And I knew it had a bit of a reputation going in. I didn't think it's quite as awful. I mean, what I just described is pretty awful, but it wasn't quite at the level of some of the movies of this era, but it's certainly, for a Polizio Tescia movie, it was different than a lot of them in that it did have this kind of sleazy element to it. But Berger was great and really kind of sold it. The girlfriend of the informant is named Juliana. She's played by Marissa Mell. You'll probably know her. She was the co-star of Danger Diabolique, the Mario Bava movie. Yep. She'd been in a bunch of stuff. Again, quite a captivating presence. A little older in this, of course. But basically, Berger kind of hooks up with her because her father owns some sort of factory or business, and Berger wants to, like, knock off the business and take all the money and pretty much, like, employs her to set up this heist. But she's, like, not into it at all. So he just, like, weird choices start happening. Like, he lets her go. She goes to the cops immediately. And then the movie just starts, I started losing me a bit just because it was getting kind of stupid. Like, you know, if he's this bad criminal, why would he let her go where she can just do whatever she wants? Of course, the first thing she's going to do is go to the cops. The cops, on the other hand, also do stupid stuff, like let her go back to him, knowing he's like this psychopathic killer that raped her. Like, so just a lot of stuff's going on where I'm just kind of like, really, guys? And I mean, it's an Italian genre movie from the 70s, so you need to expect that. But I don't know. It kind of lost me a little because of that. Richard Harrison plays the cop. He's been in tons of Italian movies and ninja movies. I thought he was pretty good, but I'd rather see someone like Henry Silva in the role or Franco Nero. So it was kind of weird seeing an American playing the cop character. Overall, I mean, I thought it was pretty good, but mainly due to Berger's performance. But I don't know if this is one that it's definitely not one I'd list at the top of my Italian crime thriller picks, but it was okay for what it was. But a little on the sleazier side, particularly because of the one scene. And I don't know, you've seemed like you've totally tuned out, but you're not really a fan of the Italian movies anyways, so but you can get this for really cheap from 88 Films.
How is the blue though?
Looked really good.
Yeah, okay.
Looked really good. And I mean, obviously this type of stuff was a huge influence on Tarantino. So if you're a Tarantino fan, you'd probably want to check this out. I mean, if he picked the movie this particular movie to feature prominently in Jackie Brown. Obviously, he loves the movie. So I would say Tarantino fans, you probably want to check it out. But yeah, I just think you can do better in this genre.
Yeah, I've seen a few that I really liked, but I'm still not fully into those kind of movies. Like, I like Roll Arm to the Teeth, I think I've mentioned in the past. I like that one. And I like some of those, but it's hard because there's so freaking many of them.
There is.
That you just don't know where to start, even if you want to try and get into them. So that's why I'm kind of really hesitant to get into them. And I'm always kind of hot or dry on cop movies to begin with and crime movies like that.
Yeah.
Like, I think I expect certain things from them, and I don't know. I mean, it doesn't sound bad, but Berger himself would probably make me want to see it.
Yeah, Berger's what sells. I mean, if you're looking for a starting point, I'd recommend Violent Naples.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just one of those ones where it felt like it couldn't decide what it wanted to be. Mm. Like, because, you know, a lot of the crime movies, you know, what you're after is the car chases and the crazy stunts and stuff and the gunplay. And this one was kind of missing some of that. Like, yeah, there was a couple of little car chases, but it wasn't like some of the other movies. Yeah. Like, even the one I watched, Violent Professionals, like, that had a way better car chase than this does. So that's why I'm watching these. I'm watching them for the action.
Oh, okay.
And this one felt more like it was leaning towards, like, Ruggiero Deodato, House on the Edge of the Park territory, but still trying to be a cop movie. And, it wasn't bad. Like, don't get me wrong. It just kind of felt not really fitting anywhere.
Hmm.
But okay. If you're a fan of Berger, if you're a fan of Tarantino, I'd recommend it.
All right. Is that available on Blu-ray North America or no? Just the 88, right?
The 88 films. And then I think Blue Underground put out Beast with a Gun as well.
Okay. Is the 88 region free? Do we know?
I don't know.
Okay. Because a lot of theirs are, so.
Yeah.
But 88 does good work, so.
Yeah.
I think if you're interested, yeah, pick it up. 88's always having sales.
Yeah, they are.
I'm going to double up on some comedies before we go to your last one, because you have one left, right?
I do.
So let's double up on some comedy. Let's get away from some sleaze and get into some yucks. First one is actually, these are both from 1977. Hey, what do you know? First one's a movie called Fun with Dick and Jane, starring George Segal and Jane Fonda. And George Segal is your typical, he seems to play this character an awful lot. He played it very similar plot for him in Carbon Copy, which I talked about not too long ago, where he plays this like successful businessman who loses his job and then starts to, like, you know, things start to go bad for him, which is what happened in Carbon Copy also.
Yeah.
But the difference is in this one, he loses his job. He's living in an affluent neighborhood with his wife, played by Jane Fonda, and they have this standard of living that they have to try and keep up, and they have to try and convince the neighbors that there's nothing wrong, that they're still have this, that they're still wealthy, so on and so forth. You know, it's got scenes of him going to the unemployment office and getting himself into trouble, getting tips from this, like, Mexican guy who used to work janitor at his old job called Raul, played by Hank Garcia, on how to get money from the government and all this stuff. And it's just like, it's just got him trying to scam his way into keeping a roof over their heads, but still make it look like they're rich.
Right.
And, from this, it turns out that, like, he comes up with this plan that him and Fonda's character are just going to start doing petty crimes. Because it's easy money, and the petty crimes are going to, like, get them, you know, they're going to have money to pay their bills. They're going to be able to throw parties and so on and so forth. So the movie just kind of follows them going on, like, a crime spree for the second half of the movie. And it's pretty fun. It's actually pretty fun. I hadn't seen this going in, so I was like, it's pretty fun. I was interested because directed by Ted Kotcheff.
Okay, yeah.
Who did... he did Wake and Fright in 1971, which is a movie I've always been curious about. He did First Blood.
Yeah.
He did Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure he might have directed that Split Image cult deprogrammer movie, too.
Yeah.
So he's got a pretty diverse filmography going for him, and you know, this is no exception. You know, I found this to have like some moments I really liked. Like, I really liked a moment, the montage they had of them doing their crimes. And like, so it's a montage in the middle of the movie where they're like, we're good at these crimes, so let's do a bunch. And they show them like robbing convenience stores and robbing all these things. And Fonda's waiting in the car looking all fancy, and he's going in with the gun and robbing them. And there's a scene where he walks into this bar, and it's a black African-American bar. And he's like going to hold them up, and then he realizes it's just all black guys in the bar. So he's like, ha, 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 have a nice day kind of thing, and like backs out. And the black guy at the bar is like, since when did they start busting in white people to rob us? And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty funny. And like, there's this really progressive scene earlier in the movie where Seagal's character's in a lineup behind this obviously transgender guy, and he's talking to the clerk, and after he leaves, Seagal's character sidles up to the desk. He's like, whoa, you check out that fruit, and starts doing all this stuff, like all this like really bad terminology about this transgender guy. And the guy behind the camera is like, he's transgender. He doesn't understand what's going on. And like this really like aware speech. And I'm like, what's this doing in a 1977 movie? It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Because you never thought that that was kind of a thing back then. And right. You see it in this movie, you're like, well, that's kind of cool, I guess, that they did that. I mean, they had to like have them use certain words that are unacceptable these days to get there.
Yeah.
But at least they did it, right? And Fonda's great in this. Like, I really appreciate 70s Fonda, like Clute, China Syndrome, all that kind of stuff. I think she was, like, after Barbarella, like, everyone fell in love with her in Barbarella, obviously. But after that, I think she put together a lot of solid movies, and I think this, she's really fun in this. She looks good. She's carrying the film for the most part. Like, Seagal's his usual grumpy self, but she's carrying this movie because she's, like, super sarcastic with him, and she's always wearing, like, the latest fashions and just, like, always looking like, how did we get in this situation? And I really liked her in this. I thought she was really fun. And, you know, just a lot of decent sniping between the two, like arguing with each other and everything. And I really thought that was fun. You got Ed McMahon from The Tonight Show as his former boss. And it ends in this scheme to try and rob his former boss. And, you know, it was just like an entertaining 95 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you know that like they were just having fun making it, right? And some of the sniping too. There's this scene where like she's saying that she wants to get a job, and he's like, you can't get a job. Like you're not able to get a job. And she's like, I wrote this down because I thought it was funny. She's like, it's interesting that you think the only two jobs I'm qualified for are a secretary and a prostitute. And then he looks at her and he goes, you're not qualified to be a secretary.
Oh,
and I'm just like, oh, burn. Yeah. And I thought that was pretty funny. And, I forgot this movie was remade in 2005.
Jim Carrey?
With Jim Carrey, yeah. And Tia Leone. I have no fucking interest in seeing that. Whoa,
whatever happened to Tia Leone?
Like, I really have no interest in seeing that. But this was actually a pretty fun little romp, and I was quite pleasantly surprised because I had kind of low expectations going in, and I thought it was pretty fun.
Cool.
So that's the first one. My second comedy from 1977 is one where I was like, it's kind of late at night. I want to watch something I've seen before that I am kind of know, so that if I fall asleep, I don't feel too bad. You know, you've had those nights probably too where you're like, I'm just going to put on an episode of The Hulk, or I'm just going to watch this movie.
Yeah.
So if I fall asleep, I don't feel too guilty. So I watched Kentucky Fried Movie for the umpteenth time.
Oh, nice.
Written by Jim Abrams, David and Jerry Zucker,
yeah,
who went on to do Airplane, Top Secret, Naked Gun. Directed by John Landis, who we have a full episode dedicated to, so you should go listen to that too, folks.
Yeah.
A lot of callbacks to episodes tonight.
Yeah.
This is the movie he made after making Schlock and before making Animal House.
Yeah.
I actually think it's this movie that probably got him the job doing Animal House. And what this is, it's another in the long line of 70s sketch comedies. There, yeah, was tons of these movies back in the day, and I'm pretty sure a good chunk of them were inspired by the success of Saturday Night Live when it came on NBC in 1975. Other ones that I we'll quickly mention is like the Groove Tube and Loose Shoes. And Loose Shoes is only notable for having like Bill Murray in it in an early role. And this one's, Kentucky Fried Movie is definitely the best of the ones that were knockoffs of Saturday Night Live. But at the same time, it's got issues. You know, all these kind of sketch things are going to be hit or miss.
Yeah.
There's going to be ones that don't work, and there's going to be ones that work great. And actually, the main problem I have with this one is A Fistful of Yen.
Oh, interesting.
Which is the spoof of Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
And the reason I have an issue with it is that it's 30 minutes long.
Yeah.
This movie's only 83 minutes long. So you're taking up a third of your running time for one sketch.
Yeah.
And it seems really an odd decision to do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some creative stuff in there in that segment. And I think Evan Kim is pretty fun aping Bruce Lee in the title role. But by the time, it was just too long. Like, by the time it got to the end and was alluding to Wizard of Oz, making fun of Wizard of Oz and everything, I'm like, I'm kind of done with this sketch.
Yeah, I agree.
Can we go back to like the 2 minute ones and stuff? Can we go back to the sketches I liked? Like, for example, Catholic high school girls in trouble. Can we go to that? Can we
Ushi Dygard's
the
shower scene?
Yeah. Can we go back to the feel around sketch, which is pretty funny with the guy going into the movie theater?
Yeah.
We're like, this movie's presented in feel around, and they have the usher standing behind him doing all the stuff that happens on the movie to him. And like Danger Seekers, which is like so off color these days, where it's like the Evel Knievel ripoff, but it's still funny.
Yeah.
I still find that stuff to be funny. Like, there's good sketches like that. You've got Rick Baker romping around in a gorilla suit in this movie, which is awesome. You've got Big Jim Slade.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say. Everyone fucking knows Big Jim Slade that's seen this movie. But then you've also got like some moments that just don't work.
Yeah.
Like, you've got the courtroom moment. The black and white courtroom scene where it's supposed to be like an old Perry Mason episode. And it's got like Tony Dow as Wally from Leave It to Beaver. And then one of the Zucker brothers playing Beaver.
Yeah.
Sitting and watching the court case. But then the court case is so off the rails that the judges are like, the lawyers are running around with like a friggin' dildo, putting it on his head going, we mean you no harm. We're new to this planet. And I'm just like, that's not funny. That doesn't really work. And then like, the disaster movie parody with George Lazenby, I didn't think worked that well.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's just, that's what you're going to get from these movies, though.
Yeah.
Like, let's be honest.
But that's why everything should be 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It's like totally hit or miss. Like, the Zuckers and Abrams nailed this kind of thing where your joke should be really fast with Airplane. 3 years later.
Yeah.
Because Airplane is fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
But that's simply because the jokes are so fast that by the time you've been like, by the time there's a bad joke, there's been three good jokes to replace it.
Yeah.
So you're willing to forgive the bad jokes. Whereas in this, it's like, okay, this is going on too long. This isn't funny. This is, but then you've got a bunch of funny ones, less funny ones in a row, and the balance isn't quite right. I think the Fistful of Yen should have probably been half of the running time it was.
Yeah.
And then maybe gone on to something else. That being said, if you're a fan of the Zuckers and Abrams and you're a fan of John Landis, you kind of got to see this.
Yeah.
Like, it's early work for them and it does have some worth and, you know, Diggard for sure.
And I think there was a scene near the end with, wasn't there like a couple on a couch?
Yeah. And they're all watching on the TV.
Yeah. I think Tara Strohmeyer's in that. And she was in, I think she was in Hollywood Boulevard. So
Yeah. It is her. And that's the final scene of the movie, actually, where the couple's making out on the couch and the newscaster's reading the news.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's like, he stops because he sees the clothes coming off. He's like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh. And he's like watching them through the TV, and then he has to pretend to still be reading news. But then all the stagehands come on.
Yeah.
And they're all watching. And then when they're making out, all the stagehands are going, oh, in the TV. And that's kind of funny.
It's pretty funny.
And it's got that.
Don't quote me on it being Tara Strohmeyer. I'm pretty sure.
I think it is.
Not 100%.
It's got that really terrible song to open the song. Hey, have you seen the karaoke?
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, too. So it's not a complete wash.
Yeah.
But just beware. You're going into a sketch comedy.
It's one of those movies that if I throw it on now, I don't think I'd watch it. I'd jump around.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Kentucky Fried Movie, 1977. Worth seeing if you're a fan of Landis or the Zuckers and Abrams team.
I have seen it many times.
Yeah, I've seen it. This is probably my sixth viewing of it. So, you know, obviously there's something that keeps you going back. It's probably Diggard and Big Jim Slade. Let's be honest.
Josh's VHS Adventures! Well, this was a nice surprise.
Really?
My God.
Please tell me.
I don't even know where to start on this. Okay. It's called Skeleton Coast.
Okay.
From 1988. So, watching the opening credits, directed by John Bud Cardos. I'm like, oh. Okay. Okay. So oftentimes with these, like, I would have picked them up. Like, these VHS didn't magically materialize in my house. Like, all of them I would have picked up for some reason. And I think probably back in the day, it was him. And it was also the fact that it stars Ernest Borgnine.
Hmm.
Anyway, John Bud Cardos, actor turned director. He was in, like, Satan's Sadist. And then he went on to direct movies like Kingdom of the Spiders. But when I saw his name on this, I'm like, okay, he's kind of a culty director. So, and
I love Kingdom of the Spiders. I really do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also knew that this movie was filmed in Namibia, and I just don't know a lot of movies that were filmed in Namibia, which is a country, near South Africa. Has a look, you know, it's the Skeleton Coast is a part of Namibia where I believe it's called that because I think a lot of elephants die there. Hmm. And it's also, but it's a really varied country. Like, it goes from there to, like, kind of like jungle. And then there's, like, desert, like the middle of the Sahara. So it's very beautiful.
So why do they die there?
Hmm?
Why do they die?
I don't know. I watched a National Geographic, documentary on it, but I don't remember why.
Huh. Okay.
Okay. So filmed in Namibia, directed by John Bud Cardos. Okay, so the movie opens with this kidnapping by these, a kidnapping of this white guy by these military troops. And it turns out the white guy is the son of Ernest Borgnine. So Ernest Borgnine goes to Namibia to try and find his son. He's like kind of like ex-army general or something. So he meets up with his old friend, played by Herbert Lom, and he's got this, like, hot black young wife named Opal. And you're kind of like, okay, something's a bit up with this guy, but they knew each other from the past, and he basically charges Borgnine a bunch of money to tell him how to find where his son was last seen. So Borgnine's like, cool, that's great. So then what he does is he goes and recruits a team of mercenaries to go and help him find his son. This is when it got good, because then I'm like, okay.
Well, I always, when you say team of mercenaries, there's going to be someone so good in
this
that
was
team.
Like, this was like, because I didn't know any of this. So the first one, so he meets up with his buddy Rick. I'm like, fuck, I know who that guy is. And it's not a super known actor, but it was a guy named Daniel Green. So he had, like, kind of longish 80s hair, and like kind of, he looked like a lot of those 80s dudes that showed up in two or three movies. Anyway, he's probably best known to B-movie aficionados as the star of a movie called Hands of Steel.
Mm.
So he shows up. That's a Sergio Martino movie. So
yeah, I have the 88 films Blu-ray.
So he's like the likable, good-looking kind of like leader of the mercs that's hooked up with Borgnine now. So then we go to, they drive out to the desert in a fucking dune buggy, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting so into this movie.
You're like, dune buggy in.
Yeah. So they to meet the other team members. So first we meet this guy named Armando, whatever, just some dude. Nothing too explosives expert, nothing too exciting.
You got me with explosives. I think I
oh,
like
Oh, yeah,
them.
They've all got their little thing, right? All right. So next.
Do they get the text thing on their?
No, no, oh. But it's just like, you know, this is Armando. He's our explosives expert.
Okay, okay.
Next, we pan along, and there's a super hot blonde having a shower, and an outdoor shower. So she's Sam. She's the, I think she's a hand-to-hand combat or something. So she's played by Nancy Mulford. Hasn't been in a lot of stuff, but really nice to look at. And I really enjoyed her in this movie. And she wasn't like getting naked. She didn't get naked at all or anything. So don't get me wrong. But she was just really an enjoyable presence in the movie. Next we meet Toshiro. Oh, and yeah. He's a Yakuza.
Oh, yeah.
Played by Peter Kwong, who... showed up in tons of 80s movies, notably Big Trouble in Little China and Never Too Young to Die. So nice. We've seen this guy around. So I'm like, you know, I'm getting more excited. Then we've got Chuck, token black guy.
Oh, yeah.
Played by none other than Too Sweet, Leon Isaac Kennedy.
Fuck yeah.
Who I love. And who's now a minister.
Really?
I had no idea.
Huh.
Yeah. So I was like, oh my God, like this, we're getting a really great cast here. Then next we meet Blade, the knife guy.
Oh.
Played by Arnold Vosloo.
Whoa.
I know. Like, oh my God.
The Mummy.
Like, it just kept getting better, right? So he shows up. And then we've got Robbins, this old Brit who's like this old army general. So they all get together and they set off on their quest. And then next thing you know, Oliver Reed shows up at the top of a sand dune and starts blowing the shit out of the mercenaries. And now one of them gets killed and there's shit blowing up. It's like Black Dog.
Fuck yeah.
And they're fighting back. And then anyway, we're really seeing all this big, first big action scene. And then Oliver Reed disappears from the movie.
Aww.
Really weird. Really weird.
That's a bummer.
Anyway, then the team move along some more.
Maybe you have to go get a drink.
That's what I think. Well, we got his name in it. Then they, you know, they kind of move along some more. They meet up with this rebel army of South Africans who, you know, agree to kind of help them. And then they end up storming the fortress led where the... where they, you know, where the son's being held by none other than Robert Vaughn.
Oh.
Totally, like, chewing up the scenery as the bad guy. And, of course, Napoleon Soto from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. But he was great in this. Borgnine, when they go to, like, assault the Robert Vaughn area, they don't really assault it. They just kind of walk in the front door. And
hey,
Borgnine pretends that he's a Cuban general. So he's talking with a Cuban accent. It's pretty priceless.
Sounds reasonable that the Cuban general would be in Africa.
Oh my God, it was ridiculous. And seeing him going like, I want to find out where are you. I was just like, oh my God, Ernest, what are you doing? You know, there's also Ernest has a great scene where like he runs into the black rebel group. You know, of course they're all, you know, speaking in Afrikaans, and he's like, doesn't anyone speak English around here? And I'm like, dude, you're in the middle of fucking Africa. Of course, you know, but it's such a Borgnine line.
Yeah.
They find a plane at one point and end up like fixing it so they can, you know, fly across the desert. And this was just so full of like great stuff. And it was a real fun time to watch. I didn't expect much from this, from the cover, but this ended up being a really, really good time. And I found out that Troma has put this out on DVD.
Oh, really?
So,
under the same title?
Under the title Skeleton Coast.
Huh.
Seems to be a little difficult to find on eBay, but it is on Troma's website available.
It's probably full frame, though, in VHS, right?
It was.
Yeah.
It was full frame, but... or it is full frame, sorry. but... I think it's still worth a look if you're if you like this kind of stuff. I just like these kind of like all-star casts, like, you know, like the Expendables or something. Like this, you know, this had a pretty great cast of like mid to late 80s action people with Borgnine as the lead, and I actually had a lot of fun with this movie. So
Borgnine made a lot of these type of movies in the late
80s,
though.
Not a lot of them. Like, he had such a great cast in this movie. I mean, this isn't a great movie.
No.
But if you're into cult movies, this is a pretty great cast. So I definitely recommend.
I think another one that he was in from this around the same time frame that's actually probably worth seeing is that Laser Mission.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
With Brandon Lee.
Brandon Lee and Ernest Borgnine.
Oh yeah, Brandon Lee.
Yeah, it's actually pretty ridiculous, but pretty fun too.
Yeah, he was all over the place. Because, I mean, he was in Escape from New York, of course, and The Black Hole.
Yeah.
But for every one of those, there's a future cop, you know? So
yeah. I guess he was just like, whatever. I'll do it. Sounds like fun.
I think he was just doing whatever. And, you know, I'll always love Ernest Borgnine because he's one. When I was a kid, I used to, like, love all these guys. And I wrote to Ernest Borgnine. And the motherfucker sent me an autograph picture. And I will always cherish that. And I think that's so cool that he did that. So
do you still have it?
I do.
Is it framed?
No, it's not. I don't know where it is, but I've seen it recently.
Oh, you got to find that shit and put it in a frame.
I know. I wrote to all these people because back in the day before privacy laws, you were able to buy books that had like celebrity addresses. So I remember I used to write to all of them. And the only ones who responded was Ernest Borgnine, Donna Mills, Linda Evans from Dynasty. I don't even know why I wrote to her. I think I was just writing to everyone.
Yeah, Dynasty doesn't seem like your kind of jam when you were a kid.
Yeah. Kirk Douglas and Charlton Heston.
Really?
Yeah. So I got some pretty great ones. So.
And were they like actual like legit like responses or were they like kind of like publicist responses?
The
or
only
whatever?
One I question is Heston.
Oh, okay.
But Borgnine and Douglas for sure. So I'm pretty happy to have
and
those.
But... Was he the only one who sent you a picture?
They all sent me an autograph picture.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
It was pretty cool.
Douglas would be a good one to have.
It's a great one to have.
Nice.
I mean, those guys were my fucking heroes.
Yeah.
And Borgnine, obviously, I loved him. You know why? Because I loved Black Hole and I loved Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah.
Like, those were like two of my favorites when I was a kid.
Wow, and so. Kirk Douglas was so cool too,
Kirk,
right?
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Like, I was just so
like, Kirk Douglas is pretty sweet.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know how awesome Kirk Douglas was, but I knew I loved 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
But that's this movie's got a pretty good ensemble cast.
Definitely worth seeking out if you
Fosloo, man. Yeah.
Fosloo, because I'm like, who is that? I know who that is. And then I'm like, it's fucking Fosloo.
It's pretty funny because I think most people just know him from The Mummy.
The Mummy and the Darkman sequels.
Yeah, I don't even think people really realize he took over for Liam Neeson in the Darkman sequels. I think mostly it's just The Mummy.
Yeah.
Because those were like direct to DVD or whatever they were. Yeah. This sounds like I might have to try and track down the DVD of this too.
It's worth a look for sure. Man.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. Skeleton Coast.
Josh's VHS Adventures. All right, Josh. Let's talk about TriStar Pictures.
All right.
Now, I don't know about you, but that logo, that Flying Pegasus, is pretty iconic for my youth. And so is the theme music that we're going to listen to right now. Okay, so quick history, then we will talk about the five movies we each individually picked that are our favorites that they released between 84 and 99.
Okay.
And then we'll do any honorable mentions.
Got
it. And we'll blow this popsicle stand.
All right.
So formed in 1982 as a venture between Columbia Pictures, CBS, and HBO.
Is that why it's called TriStar?
Could be.
Because when I was looking into it, I'm like, that makes sense. It's three companies.
Yeah. It could be because it was to split the cost of production, apparently.
Yeah.
So they like all banded together and said, let's form this studio and we can save money. So the first film they produced was actually Robert Redford's The Natural.
Right.
But it wasn't the first movie they released. That honor goes to a movie called Where the Boys Are, 84, which is a terrible movie. And is available on Blu-ray from Code Red, I believe.
Scorpion.
Or is it Scorpion? One of them.
Yeah, I think it's Scorpion. Yeah.
But it's out of print, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, is it already? Yeah.
I think so. So CBS left in 85, HBO left in 86, and Columbia was left holding the bag. But they still continued, you know, putting out these movies that were... I always felt they were like the home for more off-the-cuff Hollywood productions, like stuff that wasn't like big enough budgeted to be like a premiere title but not low enough budgeted to be like the kind of stuff that like a company like Embassy or someone was putting out, just kind of like genre type Hollywood movies is kind of what TriStar meant to me growing up.
Yeah,
kind of like that.
But they did put out some pretty big like some pretty mainstreamy movies too.
They did, but they were mostly like more offbeat kind of non-genre. So they were kind of like what Fox does with Searchlight, where it's movies that aren't quite under the main banner, but something they feel is worthy of putting out. That's what TriStar was for Columbia Pictures. So it's gone through various iterations over time. And now they've been stuck mostly doing like co-productions and only producing the 1 to 3 films a year, like I said. And that fucking Flying Pegasus logo, man. That's all I could say. That's like my favorite thing about the company. But there's a lot of really sweet movies they put out too, and we'll talk about those. But like we said earlier, we're only covering the first 15 years of their existence.
Yeah.
So 84 to 89. We're also kind of excluding any titles that they distributed only. So that would be like the Carol Co. movies like Total Recall and Universal Soldier and the HBO films like The Hitcher and stuff like that. That's stuff they just distributed. So we're not counting that. And we're not really counting movies that they co-produced.
Yeah.
So like a movie like, for example, Labyrinth.
Yeah.
Short Circuit, Starship Troopers, things like that. Stuff that they didn't just produce in-house by themselves is not on our list.
Yes, and these were Chris's rules, and thank you very much.
I cut it down for you quite a bit. You're welcome. So let's dive into our top five TriStar releases. Who wants to start? Me? You're looking at me like you want me to start. So
no,
I will.
I'm just young. You go ahead.
Okay. The first one I wrote down is from 1990. It's a movie directed by Philip Noyce, starring Rutger Hauer. That movie's called Blind Fury.
How many times could Blind Fury come up on
a
this show?
A lot, because I want a lot of people to watch Blind Fury. So Blind Fury, we've talked about this many times in the past, so I'm not going to really go over it that much. Just a really cool action movie with Rutger Hauer as a blind swordsman. Who's recruited by who's called from his old Vietnam buddy, played by Terry O'Quinn, to come and like take care of his son and also try and stop the bad guys who have like kind of kidnapped his friend by using his sword skills and his extrasensory perception since he can't see them. Randall Tex Cobb makes a really cool villain in it. Sho Kasugi shows up for a fight near the end of the movie. And I just thought it was a really fun, cool kind of movie with like a lot of fun action sequences. A lot, like, you know, the kid was annoying at first, but by the end of the movie you're kind of like, oh, he's all right.
Yeah.
And it's just like a fun 86 minutes, and it's the kind of movie that you wouldn't see a Hollywood studio really putting out these days.
No.
So that's why it's my first choice. And Philip Noyce has definitely gone on to a lot more bigger movies since. He made Dead Calm before this, which is a really great thriller. But he went on to make the Clear and Present Danger, I believe it is, one of those Harrison Ford ones, and the various other bigger studio movies. So this is his start, and it's definitely worth seeking out. And it's easy to get a hold of because it's on a three-feature Blu-ray from Mill Creek with, what is it, White Line Fever and Blind Rage, is it?
Silent Rage.
Silent Rage.
Yeah.
The Chuck Norris versus serial killer movie.
Yeah, and I remember one of the henchmen in this was really good too. I can't remember who the actor was, but he really stood out as well.
Was he the one who was always with Randall Tex Cobb's character? He was kind of a cowboy type.
Kind of a cowboy. He wasn't with Randall Tex Cobb. Randall Tex Cobb was kind of on his own.
Yeah, okay.
But it was him and his brother. They were.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Those guys. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just an all around fun movie. Like a lot of fun and like breezy 86 minutes and.
Yeah, it flies by.
Rutger Hauer's always good.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What's your first?
My first is a movie shot in our hometown, or my hometown, sorry, Vancouver, BC.
Yep.
And it's a little movie called Runaway.
Which is also on my list.
Oh, of course. It's from 1984, directed by Michael Crichton of Jurassic Park fame. And this is a movie that was featured on our Killer Robots episode, another callback.
Yep.
But it's pretty kick-ass. It's a futuristic movie. Tom Selleck and Cynthia Rhodes from Dirty Dancing playing cops.
Yep.
And they're after Gene Simmons, who's who's from Kiss, who's created these like little mini robot spider things. Yeah. Kirstie Alley shows up, and It's a lot of fun. I loved this movie.
And those little mini spider robots have stingers in them.
Yeah.
That will make you die.
They will. And there's...
I just remember the first time I saw Runaway, I thought it was super cool because the opening scene has Tom Selleck's character like having to like basically go into this house where one of these robots has gone crazy. It's like one of those robots that's supposed to be like helping the family by like doing like kind of like the maid in the Jetsons sort of like the Rosie the robot or whatever her name is. It's supposed to be like that, but it's gone crazy and is like gonna kill everybody, and Tom Selleck's the guy who's called in to stop it because he's part of this like special unit that deals with robot crime.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this movie's so cool, it's so ahead of its time, robots are gonna take over. I remember thinking it was so cool, and then I'm like, Gene Simmons, I really love Kiss too. Yeah. And then he would go on to be in like Never Too Young to Die and Wanted Dead or Alive with Rutger Hauer. And it's Runaway's a pretty fun movie, and unfortunately hasn't made it past DVD so far.
Yeah, I can't believe that.
Somebody's got to do this.
Like, this is right for Scream Factory. Like, I just don't know why.
Somebody's got to do
it. It must
Runaway.
Be a rights thing, like, why no one's picking this up, but God.
Could be. And actually, Michael Crichton was a really solid director in his day. Like, I don't think he gets quite enough credit for the kind of stuff he directed, because he made, like, Looker in 81, Terminal Man in the 70s. He made that pretty fun 70s TV movie I've talked about in the past, Hot Pursuit.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was a pretty solid director.
He made fucking Westworld, man.
And Westworld, yes. And, you know, Jurassic Park. He wrote the book Jurassic Park, you know? Yeah. He did a lot of good stuff in
his
career.
And he created ER. He's done some really neat stuff.
Yeah, he did it. But I think Runaway is the movie that nobody really talks about that he did.
Yeah, that's because, you know, it just needs one of these. I think Scream Factory, that's who should be picking this one up.
Yeah, they should.
Yeah.
Them or Kino, one of the two.
Yeah.
They seem to be, like, trading titles, so.
Yeah.
Just fucking put Runaway out on Blu-ray already.
Please.
Is what we're trying to say. I'll buy it. Josh will buy it.
I'll absolutely buy it.
You got two guaranteed sales right there.
You know, I've actually been holding off. I haven't seen the DVD, the DVD. So I saw this in the theater back in the day, and then I've seen it on VHS. So I've never seen it at home in widescreen, and I've intentionally not bought the DVD because I'm waiting for someone to put it on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I actually have the DVD.
Yeah.
But the first time I saw this was on late night TV.
Yeah.
And when I was like probably 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is the cool. Look at Magnum's fighting robots. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I honestly thought Tom Selleck was pretty cool back in the day. Like, a lot of people crap on him, too, a little bit. But I always thought he was a solid action hero in the stuff he was in.
Yeah, he was great in this.
So, yeah that was one of mine, too. So you might as well do your next one.
Okay. Funny, I honestly I was trying to go through the list going what won't Chris pick, because there was a lot of really obvious ones to me, but this might be one you picked, and it's The Principal.
I didn't pick it.
All right,
but it's on my honorable mentions. So I love The Principal.
The Principal from 1987.
It's a pretty badass movie.
It is. I love the urban crime, as everyone knows, and I particularly love the urban crime high school
movies.
Dude,
I'm with you. I fucking love urban crime high school movies.
Yeah, and I love, like, Class of 1984 is one of my all-time favorites.
315, The Moment of Truth.
Yeah, so this was right up my alley. 1987, directed by Christopher Kane, who went on to do Young Guns. But starring Jim Belushi, of all people.
Yep.
I think I've seen him in, like, he was, I think, A Boat Last Night and stuff like that was before this.
Yeah, and then after this, after Principal, he did, like, K-9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this was kind of his breakout movie. Yep. And but before that, he was kind of known as, John Belushi's brother and supporting, like, buffoon, usually. And, but this movie, he was a lead, and it was a drama, and it was about a fucking high school, and he was the principal, and he came in, and he had to, like, clean shit up because of the gang was, you know, after him, and Lou Gossett Jr.
was the
security, like, head of security at the high school.
Who helps him clean the fucking shit up.
Because that's the kind of high school it was, where they needed a security officer.
Damn right.
Michael Wright played the leader of the gang. I think he tried Radon Chong played another teacher, and I believe Michael Wright like was trying to assault her, Radon Chong, and that's what got Belushi all mad because he was kind of into her. Kelly Minter from Nightmare on Elm Street 4, I think, shows up. Well, she's got quite a large role in this. S.I. Morales shows up,
oh, yeah,
who fucking is awesome. And if you've only seen S.I. Morales in La Bamba, you need to check out this. You need to check out Bad Boys. And you need to check him out on NYPD Blue because he's awesome in all three of those areas. So yeah, this is just this kind of movie I love, and I as soon as I saw it on the list, I'm like, oh yeah, fucking the principal's awesome.
Yeah.
And then was this the only one, or am I getting confused with The Substitute, which was very similar?
The Substitute had sequels. This principal didn't. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but The Substitute was also like,
yeah, it was the same kind of thing.
Cleaning up.
Yeah, Tom Berenger was like a ex,
like
Navy SEAL or something who had to come into a school and clean it up.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Like I love those movies, and then Treat Williams I think took over for him in the sequels.
Yeah, I actually don't like The Substitute.
No,
that
I
much.
Like them.
I prefer
I love
the principal.
Yo, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. The principal was the best, but I love those kind of movies with the guy coming in to clean up the school.
I generally have a soft spot for like 80s movies that revolve around teachers and stuff.
Yeah.
Even if they're not clearing up a high school, if they're working in an inner city high school, like the movie Teachers from 1984 with Nick Nolte.
Or Stand and Deliver.
Yeah, I usually just like those movies in general. Yeah. But when you add the badass element of like fucking Belushi with a bat and fucking Lou Gossett Jr. like flexing in the background, beating the shit out of gangsters, I'm like, I'm so in right now.
Yeah.
I'm so in. Yeah, Principal's a great one.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, only available on full frame DVD.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Damn it.
So there you go. Hey, Kino?
Kino, Well, Kino, this is a good Kino one.
come on, guys. Come on.
I hope we get one title out of tonight in the next month.
Let's go for another Lou Gossett Jr. title.
Really?
Let's talk Iron Eagle from 86. You knew this was coming, right? Now, I have a really soft spot for Iron Eagle. I mean, I know some people don't like Iron Eagle, but they're fucking crazy. So this is like kind of the teen version of Top Gun in a way, I guess you'd call it. Directed by Sidney J. Furey, who's a very prolific Canadian director, made a really cool movie in the late 70s called The Boys and Company C, which is worth seeing. Made all four of the Iron Eagle movies, if you can believe it. There's four. And they all got Lou Gossett in them, so get on it. So this has Jason Gedrick as the lead, and he's this like high school kid whose jet fighter flying dad, played by Tim Thomerson from the Trancers movies, gets kidnapped and taken behind enemy lines in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
And, you know, rather than sit back and let the government do nothing, what does Jason Gedrick do? He fucking learns to fly a fighter jet from Lou Gossett Jr. He flies the fuck into the Middle East and saves his fucking dad. That's what Jason Gedrick does. And this movie is rad. I'm sorry. It's so fun. It's got like this super cool 80s soundtrack. Some of his friends are played by like a guy like Larry B. Scott from Revenge of the Nerds. And it's just a fun movie. And Gedrick wasn't really in much else, really.
No, he wasn't.
He was in a movie called, I think he was in that movie Rooftops in 89.
Right.
Which was like that musical directed by Robert Wise, who made West Side Story, of all things. But he wasn't in a lot.
No.
And this one's just a lot of fun. Like, who doesn't have a fantasy of like being the super guy who can fly a jet in and save your dad from the middle of fucking nowhere by bombing everything? Like, come on. That's like the sweetest thing ever. And the other movies in the series kind of became more standard, like Top Gunny than this. Like a lot more. Lou Gossett Jr.'s made a team of fighter jets to go in and fight. And what didn't have this teen movie angle that the first one does.
Right.
And that's what makes the first one definitely my preferred of the Iron Eagle movies. And definitely one of the TriStar movies I totally remember watching endlessly on VHS back in the day.
Nice. Yeah, it was a good one.
You've seen Iron Eagle, I'm
assuming. I've seen the first one. I don't know if I've seen the sequels.
Yeah, the sequels are meh, but at least part three has Rachel Tickleton in it.
So you got that.
Yeah.
In like a friggin' like tank top, all muscular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Badass.
All right, what's next?
Real Genius.
Nice, yep.
1985. Directed by Martha Coolidge of Valley Girl fame.
Valley Girl, she was a Valley Girl.
I didn't appreciate this movie as much back in the day.
Yep.
When I first saw it, but I did see it a few years ago when I was down in LA and I watched it at the Cine Family, and John Grease was there, and that was a really great experience. But this one stars Val Kilmer as actually, it stars Gabriel Jarrett as a kid named Mitch, who's in a school, like a technical school, where they're trying to, like, it's a bunch of really smart kids working on different projects. He befriends their, I can't remember if they were, like, really friends, but him and he connects with the teacher, played by William Atherton, who's, like, trying to create a rocket, I believe, or something like that. Anyway, he enlists the help of his roommate, Chris, played by Val Kilmer, who is the real genius, and but also kind of a slacker, mm-hmm. and kind of like the cool guy who like doesn't really give a shit, and but they're trying to get his, you know, him to help because he's also the smartest guy of them all, and it's just about, you know, just the hijinks that are going on at this school while they're trying to create this thing, and then we find out about like some nefarious purposes behind it and so forth. Robert Prescott shows up as kind of like the asshole. He's usually the asshole in movies. Most 80s fans will remember him as Cole from Bachelor Party. So he plays a very similar role in this. As I mentioned, John Grease is one of the classmates. And, of course, Michelle Mayrink is the love interest, and she's great in this as well. But, yeah, it's a really, really fun movie, and you know, I didn't really get Kilmer's early career, and I think a lot of it was because I didn't catch a lot of these in the theater, so I knew him as Iceman from Top Gun, and I didn't really get him as this guy or Top Secret, so I didn't really get those movies, and I don't think I really got the comedy, because this one is not like a pratfall-y comedy. It's a little more intelligent than some of the other ones, so but it's really held up. I mean, seeing it recently, I think it's a really, really well-done 80s comedy, and yeah.
Yeah, I really like Real Genius, but it's been a while since I've seen it, so that's kind of why I didn't put it on mine, because I know you had seen it much more recently than I had. But you're right about Kilmer. Like, I love Top Secret.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I think they're, Top Secret's starting to get that notice of being like a really good movie that nobody paid attention to when it came out. And that's another one. Blu-ray. Where's Real Genius? Blu-ray. What's going on, people?
Oh, yeah. Neither of them.
Like, come on. Yeah. Come on, everybody. This is mostly just me ranting about what I want on Blu-ray, I guess. But, yeah, Real Genius is a good choice, because it was one of those ones where going in, you felt like it was going to be a typical teen comedy, but then it ended up being a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
And it's got to do with, like, you know, the premise in the first place, because you're actually, you know, like, it's like kind of Revenge of the Nerdsy in the fact that all the characters are like super smart, but without quite the sleaze of Revenge of the Nerds, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's and it's got like this social message, because there's like military, like, you know, is, you know, using smarts for the wrong reasons and things like that. So, and it's got a lot of popcorn in it too. So,
like the song Popcorn?
No, actual popcorn.
Oh, okay, I was like, I don't remember that part.
Oh, you'll remember it if you see it again. Right. You'll be I know what he's
talking. I do have the DVD of it, so.
But I wonder if this is a TriStar thing.
What do you mean?
Well, none of the movies we've talked about have come out on...
Well, it's a Sony thing.
So that's what's going on.
I think I've heard Sony's really, like, shitty when it comes to putting stuff out on Blu-ray, to be honest.
None of the movies we've talked about are out on Blu-ray yet.
Because if you think about it, Christine, remember we were talking earlier?
Yeah.
Christine was Twilight Time. Fright Night was Twilight Time. And then Sony finally put out Christine, and they're finally putting out
Fright Night.
Fright Night. And those are Columbia Pictures too, which is kind of TriStar-y. And look how long it's taken them to bona fide horror
classics.
Classics. Yeah. and look how long it takes them.
Yeah.
Blu-ray's been around since 2007. So it's been 12 years since Blu-ray's been around, and they're just getting around to Fright Night in North America.
Like, God, I hope they get off their ass and, like,
yeah.
If they're not going to put it out, just let someone else put
just
it out.
Just go the way of Warner Archive, then.
Yeah. Or let license it out to someone else.
Yeah, I've heard their licensing is apparently quite shitty. That's why it's hard to get their titles.
Huh.
They're very hesitant.
It's weird.
Which makes no sense.
Doesn't make any sense.
However, the next one I know is out on Blu-ray and is coming out on a super special edition from Scream Factory soon, and is the movie that you knew was most obviously going to be on my list. And that's Night of the Creeps.
Oh,
from 1986. You knew this would be on my list.
Yeah, I did know that.
Night of the Creeps is probably my favorite horror comedy, probably of all time, actually.
Yeah.
I love Night of the Creeps, directed by Fred Decker. I'm not a huge fan of Fred Decker's other work, to be honest. I don't think Monster Squad is as great as everyone thinks it is. I don't care for RoboCop 3. And Predator can go fuck itself. The Predator can go fuck itself, to be honest.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, considering Shane Black's also involved with that.
Yeah.
But Night of the Creeps was a perfect storm for me. I originally saw it on a free Super Channel weekend when they played all the movies. I saw it along with, like, Critters and Maximum Overdrive and The Kindred and all that. Like, they'd have a free weekend and I'd tape everything.
Oh, I remember those. That just brought me back.
Like, remember that? You'd get it Friday night. They'd be like, Super Movie Channel's free until Sunday night. And you'd be like, fuck, where's all my VHS tapes? And you'd be like taping three movies on a tape. Yeah. And then you'd watch them incessantly. And I remember it was like one time it was like, it was Critters. The original Critters, it was Night of the Creeps, it was Maximum Overdrive, it was like The Kindred, it was all these like, the Trick or Treat.
Yeah.
You're like, man, there's some good movies coming out in 1986.
Yeah.
So that's when I first saw it, and ever since then, I'm like, I watch it all the time, I quote it, I'm like, oh, this movie is so much fun. Tom Atkins, most iconic role of his career, I think, after probably Halloween 3 now, unfortunately. But, you know, he's playing the detective. He has all those lines. Good news is your dates are here. Bad news is they're dead.
Yeah.
Thrill me.
Yeah.
All those kind of lines. Jason Lively's a really fun teenage lead in this. Well, I guess he's kind of college age, but he's a good lead in it. He plays really well off Atkins. And then Jill Whitlow, who really hasn't been in a lot of stuff. I thought she was super cute in this movie, and I thought she was a lot of fun too, and she wasn't in much,
no,
to be honest. And I just think this is like just the mix of like having the oldies and the flashbacks, the zombies, the killer slugs, the gore gags, just all that kind of fun stuff, the jokes.
Yeah.
His friend who had the crutches, who was cracking wise through the whole thing, who I loved, and lines like screaming Reich banshees and stuff like that. It's just, I love the movie. I really do love this movie. And I'm hoping that when they release the new version, it has the theatrical ending.
Yeah.
Because I got to be fully honest with you, I don't like the director's cut ending.
Yeah.
I much prefer the theatrical ending.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that both are included on the new Scream Factory disc, but I already own Night of the Creeps on Blu-ray, but I'm still buying the new version because I love this movie so much.
Are you going to try and get that action figure?
No, I don't. I can't spend that kind of money, but I'm buying the Blu-ray for sure day one.
Yeah.
Especially if they're including both endings.
Yeah.
But I love Night of the Creeps, and anyone who knows me knows I love Night of the Creeps, and I'm surprised you didn't pick that up as the most obvious one going in.
I think I did. I just,
you probably did. You just didn't think about it till I said it. But great movie. Great
cool
movie.
All right. The big hit.
Yep.
1998, directed by Kirk Wong. I think this is a pretty fun. Wasn't this on your underrated list?
I was on my underrated, yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of like, it was an action movie that, a lot of the Arnie movies and stuff had comedy in them, but this was done in a bit of a different way, where it was really, it seemed really self-aware. And it was almost comic booky in a way, I thought. Really great leads in this. Mark Wahlberg, Lou Diamond Phillips, Bokeem Woodbine, and Antonio Sabata Jr. They're a team that get together and then eventually break apart. But I thought they were all great in this. China Chow plays this girl who Mark Wahlberg's character is set to kidnap her as a job, and then ends up kind of falling for her and getting involved in a big criminal plot. But she was really really quite good in this. Christina Applegate plays Wahlberg's girlfriend or wife, and Elliot Gould plays her dad, and they were both hilarious. And it's got like a fight in a video store. King Kong Lives features prominently in the plot.
Yep.
Lou Diamond Phillips is pretty great in what he's doing in this, and this is really the one that really kind of brought out Mark Wahlberg as in my opinion, as kind of an action guy, but also really kind of brought out this kind of personality he's really built on since then. But this was at the beginning, and it kind of moved him from Marky Mark into a legit actor. And I don't think enough people have either seen this, because I don't think it was a big hit at the time.
Not at all.
Yeah. So I think it kind of flew under the radar. And I think even like a lot of big Wahlberg fans probably haven't gone back to this one. But or maybe it's just not for all people. But I felt it really appealed to my B-movie sensibilities just in the whole way it was put together. And I think that's with a Hong Kong action guy at the helm.
Hong Kong-flavored action sequences. Yeah,
big time. So it's a really cool movie. And, when you talked about TriStar, like, not putting out the mainstream stuff, this is a really good example of that. It's an action movie, probably could have been kind of mainstream, but it had this weird edge to it that probably wasn't for a big studio.
Yeah, I can tell you this movie wasn't a big hit.
Yeah.
Because I saw it opening night, and the theater was pretty much empty.
Yeah, I saw the theater too.
Yeah, like I feel like I'm one of the few people who actually saw this movie in the theaters. Yeah. And I remember loving it.
Yeah, me
in
too.
Theaters. And I've seen it since. I have the Blu-ray of it at home. So this is out on Blu-ray too.
Yeah.
But it's a fun movie. And, I'm not a huge fan of Wahlberg, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like Boogie Nights for me, and then not much else apart from Big Hit. But in this movie, I'm all about Bokeem, man.
Yeah.
He's the shit in this movie. Yeah. He really is. And that joke with him being like the number one adult film customer of the year at the video store. Every time I see that, I still fucking laugh. It's a pretty fun, rompy, Hong Kong inspired action comedy. And it's definitely worth seeking out, especially if you're kind of tired of this new patriotic American hero Wahlberg.
Yeah.
In all these movies he's doing where he's just like that, I'm an American hero. Look at me shoot people. I have this expression on my face like I'm having no fun.
Yeah.
You want to see him doing something that's actually fun but still shooting people? Then watch The Big Hit.
Yeah, and I kind of miss that Wahlberg. You're right.
Just really dour now and just like,
yeah.
And then every once in a while he'll make fun of himself and it's okay. But I've never really been a big fan of him to begin with.
Yeah.
And this is one of the movies I'm like, if he would have kind of kept in this vein, I might have liked him more. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a fun movie.
Yeah.
My last one is a remake from 1988, directed by Chuck Russell, called The Blob.
Yeah.
I love The Blob. Starring Kevin Dillon, Shawnee Smith, among others. The thing I like about the 88 Blob is that it didn't pull punches when it came to the actual blob stuff.
Yeah.
Like the practical effects in this one are so damn good. Like the guy being sucked down the sink drain, the phone booth, the movie theater scene, they're all so well done. And then when you hear how they achieve some of them, you're just like, your mind is blown.
Yeah.
Because it's like such simple ways they did it, but it looks so cool on screen. And I thought Kevin Dillon made a pretty good hero in this, for the most part. But I was all about Shawnee Smith after this movie. I remember seeing her in this and seeing her in Summer School and having this big crush on her.
Right.
And again, I don't think she really did a lot of these type of movies later in her career to keep me that interested in her. But at the time, she was really cool to me with the Blob and Summer School and everything.
Who was she in Summer School?
She was... pretty sure she was in Summer School, or maybe I'm getting her confused with Courtney Thorne Smith.
Courtney Thorne Smith was in Summer School.
Yeah.
My thing with Shawnee Smith is I can't separate her from the Saw movies.
She was in something else cool around the time of the Blob.
I know she was, but it's just like there's the Saw movies, and then I can't place young Shawnee Smith. It's interesting, but
yeah, but she's been in stuff that I liked back
then. Yeah.
You know, I just thought that this was a really well done, muscular, entertaining, gory, cool effects kind of movie. And this is the kind of stuff that in the late 80s I was digging on big time. I was into the creature effects and I was into all that stuff. And this one certainly delivered everything I wanted. And I don't, I find this better than the original Steve McQueen Blob, to be honest with you. I understand that a lot of people love the original Blob. And I do like the original Blob, but I always found that it was kind of, after seeing this one, I couldn't watch the original yeah. properly because I saw them in reverse order. And I was like, I get it, but I just can't do it. Seeing red jello coming out of the movie theater in the original, and then seeing people getting fucking dragged into the ceiling and ripped apart in a movie theater in the remake, it's not the same.
Yeah.
It's just the same. So, yeah.
I haven't seen this since it came out.
It's another one that's on Blu-ray from Twilight Time and never got a second life yet.
Yeah, I think, didn't Umbrella put it out?
Umbrella put it out, but it's like, that's if you're region free. And I keep thinking about it, but I know they released a version that had this, that, and the original together. And that one's harder to come by for some reason. Because I wouldn't mind having the original Blob, but I don't want to buy the Criterion.
Yeah, I have the Criterion, and I have the Twilight Time of this, but I just haven't cracked it.
Yeah, so. it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
A lot of
fun.
Nice. So is that our five, or do you have one
left? No, my last one is The Quick and the Dead from 1995.
Yep, that's on my honorable mentions.
Sam Raimi. I mean, I've talked about this pretty recently, but it's just a Western that has Raimi's, like, style that we love, you know, and, you know, Raimi's gone in and out of his style, you know, over the years. But this was like a Western with like Evil Dead camera work. And it's awesome. Sharon Stone against type was great as the lady, the the lead gunslinger who's gone to this town to enter a contest to get revenge, basically, for the death of her father. Gene Hackman is the antagonist. And Hackman is always great. Didn't have a lot of fun making the movie, according to sources, but still rocks it. I mean, Hackman's good in everything. Russell Crowe in one of his early roles. Leonardo DiCaprio in one of the movies that I thought really brought him out, kind of like Wahlberg in the other one. Like, this really made me notice him. I mean, everyone says Gilbert Grape, but this is the one that really made me first notice Leo. And then you've got a lot of genre guys showing up. Keith David, Lance Henriksen, Mark Boone Jr., Tobin Bell, and Robert Swossom from Deranged. So just a really cool cast. I love contest movies as tournament movies. So this is a tournament of gunslingers where they're like trying to blow each other away in duels. And it's just, it's really great. So,
yeah, I remember this is a movie I got from the... Columbia House Home Video Club on VHS, and I wore the tape out because I loved Evil Dead, and I was like, oh my god, Sam Raimi's made a Western, and look at the fucking camera goes right through that bullet hole, and I'm like, this is the sweetest thing ever. And
like, I like Western. This is my, like, might be one of my favorite Westerns.
Yeah, nobody talks about it, though.
No, I know.
Like, nobody talks about it. Even in the Sam Raimi filmography, this movie, I think this and probably... The Gift are the two least talked about movies that he made.
It's true.
And that's unfortunate because they're both really good movies.
Yeah.
like even Crime Wave gets talked about more than The Quick and the Dead, and,
Crime Wave's
not a very good movie.
No, that's not a very good movie.
So yeah, that's on my honorable mentions too.
Nice.
So let's talk about honorable mentions. I got a bunch of titles written down. Did you write some?
I only wrote one down.
Go for it.
Bugsy. Just because it's notable. Well, I just talked about it last week, or was it 2 weeks ago? Two episodes ago, or was it last episode?
Last episode.
Yeah, last episode. So it's the Warren Beatty tale of Bugsy Siegel and how Vegas got started. And go back to the last episode if you want to hear me talk about it at length. But it's notable for being an Oscar, big Oscar nominee for TriStar.
Okay, and the only other ones I have written down are The Last Dragon.
Yeah.
From 1985, which is a kind of a Motown-y kung fu movie starring T-Mac.
Yeah, I couldn't remember if I liked it or not.
I remember liking it. I haven't seen it in a while. I have the Blu-ray. It's just one of those weird movies that, like, only TriStar could put out.
Yeah.
Because it's like a kung fu, hip-hop, Motown amalgamation with like a young black kid doing karate in Detroit, and it's just such a weird fucking movie, but I love it. Like,
yeah.
Vanity, T-Mac, Berry Gordy produced it. I'm like, it's a lot of fun. Another one I wrote down is The Legend of Billie Jean.
I've never seen that.
Also from 1985. That's a pretty fun movie too. Helen Slater,
yeah,
playing this teenage girl who goes on kind of a crime spree and becomes like an anti-hero, and co-starring Christian Slater and Yardley Smith, who plays Lisa Simpson's voice on The Simpsons.
Oh, and she's in Maximum Overdrive
yeah, as the most annoying character in Maximum Overdrive. But that's a fun movie that I grew up with and watched a lot, readily available on Blu-ray from Mill Creek for like under $10. Yeah. Rad from 1986.
Yeah.
Directed by Hal Needham from
I thought that would have been on your list for sure.
It was close.
Yeah.
It was close. A movie that has never made it past VHS and makes me sad all the time.
Yeah.
So, trend movie, cashing in on the BMX trend, starring Lori, I pay to get my daughter into University Lachlan, among other people. A fun BMX contest movie with a fucking dance scene on BMXs to fucking Send Me an Angel. Awesome. I love Rad, and I know a lot of people love Rad, and it needs to come out, and it's probably a rights issue with music, I'm assuming, that's keeping it from coming out. Silent Night, Deadly Night from 1984. Pulled out of theaters after like a week, but a TriStar release. And I actually really do like Silent Night, Deadly Night. I watched it this past Christmas season, and how can you go wrong with a Santa Claus slasher movie where you got Linnea Quigley naked for part of the movie, you got heads rolling down hills, you got a guy yelling naughty and killing people left, right, and center, and you got a friggin' insane nun punishing everybody.
It's a pretty fun
movie. That unfortunately had four really bad sequels, and I don't give a fuck if you like part two, you're crazy. Part two is like 40 minutes of flashbacks and one scene where he goes, "It's garbage day," that everybody fucking loves. Fuck you, it's not a good movie, sorry. And then the last one I want to mention, and it's not a movie I particularly like, but I think it's one of the biggest hits for TriStar in this period that we're covering. That's Look Who's Talking, with John Travolta and Kirstie Alley. I think this was a huge hit for them at the time. And I did see it in theaters with my mom back when I was 14. So I just thought I'd mention it quickly. Aww,
little Chris with his mom.
I know. We saw Ghost and Look Who's Talking in the span of a year together in theaters.
Aww. Didn't they do Three Men and a Baby as well?
That's Touchstone.
Oh, it's not TriStar?
Yeah, not TriStar.
I know. Okay, so maybe I was looking at Look Who's Talking and thinking of babies or something.
You're probably looking at Look Who's Talking, and I don't hate Look Who's Talking, but it's not worthy of being like, well, if you want to see what TriStar is all about, watch Look Who's Talking.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd bring it up because it is like a pretty important movie in this time frame for the company, because they did make a lot of money with that one.
Yeah.
So recap: Blind Fury, Runaway, Iron Eagle, No, The Creeps and the Blob. What about you?
And Quick and the Dead and The Big Hit.
Yeah.
And Real Genius and The Principal.
Nice.
And Runaway, of course.
So as I said at the beginning, you don't get much more niche than what we've just done. This is just another one where we're spitballing, throwing out ideas, and we're hoping you like it. If you do, you can let us know on our Facebook discussion group or on Twitter or on Instagram. Just search for GBW Podcast. And
yeah, we've actually been getting some action there lately.
Yeah, guys, I didn't think meatballs would ever start that big of a fucking discussion. And to answer the questions, Meatball's not a good series. I will admit I would probably rather watch the Meatballs movies than the Children of the Corn movies, to be honest with you. And rate and review on iTunes. And most importantly, if you like the show, tell a friend. And let's spread the word. Anything else to add there, Mr. Josh?
No, you covered it.
All right. That's it, folks. Until next time, we is out.
Okay, bye.